Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriot. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
Hey, yeah, it's me, 2022 Oregon gubernatorial candidate Leon Noble. You know what really grinds my gears? I was excluded from a debate on July 29th because I didn't spend millions of dollars in advertising to win my primary election in Oregon. No, we got it in writing. No pay, no play. The time for playing nice is over. Now it's fire for effect. So even though you owe me nothing, I want you to do me a favor. Jump online, point your browser of choice to setoregonfree.com, click that donate button, and donate to Set Oregon Free, so that our Oregon candidates will have their message heard by the public of Oregon, even if you don't like what we have to say. I'm not asking for your vote, I'm asking for your help. Lend me your voice, and together we will set Oregon free. Paid for by Set Oregon Free, 22239.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day, helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
What do you think you're doing?
You call this a room? This is a pigsty. I want you to straighten up this area now. You are a disgusting slob. Are you listening to me? What do you want to do with your life?
I want to rot.
We ain't gonna take it. Oh, we're not gonna
All right, everybody. Hello, hello. You are tuned in to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann special, my special Wednesday. and, of course, that song you just heard was We're Not Gonna Take It by Twisted Sister. And, you know, how appropriate is that? I heard it the other day, and it's, you know, one of those songs that I always liked, but I just never really, I haven't really listened to it for a long time. And then, you know, I'm going on YouTube, and I'm listening to some songs, good old mid-80s, 1984, Twisted Sister, We're Not Gonna Take It. And how relevant is that song right now in 2022? Very. I mean, some of the lyrics are very fitting. We've got the right to choose it. There ain't no way we'll lose it. This is our life. This is our song. We'll fight the powers that be. Just don't pick our destiny. Because you don't know us. You don't belong. We're not going to take it. Oh, no, we ain't going to take it. We're not going to take it anymore. It's just, I think that the sentiment really hasn't gone away, has it? Even now more than ever. More government overreach. More and more and more. We, over the last year and a half, have been experiencing and witnessing the largest ever global transfer of wealth from the poor and middle class to the rich, the powerful, the global elite, corporations, governments, more and more and more. I can so get into that. hopefully we'll discuss more about that, like the latest news after I play the clips that I intend to play tonight. So tonight what I have planned is a series of a documentary called The Best Kept Secret, Best Kept Secret by Sean Stone. Sean Stone is the son of Oliver Stone, and he did this documentary. I've watched some of it, but not all of it. But what I did watch, I was like, oh yeah, I should probably pick this series as the next series to play on my midweek Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann special. It has a total of 6 parts, which each one of the parts are separated out that are about 30 minutes long or so. So I'm thinking tonight I can play the first half of those, play the first 3, then get through those, and then that way during the second half of the show we can open it up for discussion, as we usually do. So hopefully we get some people calling in to have some discussion, talk about what's going on this week in politics, current events, all that kind of stuff. So for this series, if you go to the link for this show's episode, go to blogtalkradio.com and then look up Lucid Libertarian and then open up this link, and you will get a link to first of it, you know, the first episode or the first part of The Best Kept Secret, or you can search for it. It's available online. I got it from BitChute. I tend to go to BitChute and Rumble more and more for these kinds of things. But I'm sure, you know, if you look up Best Kept Secret by Sean Stone, S-E-A-N, Stone, you should be able to find it, and you should be able to watch these videos, which, of course, I do encourage you to do, because obviously with the audio only, you miss the visuals. So this documentary that he did, I will quote what it's about: human trafficking, pedophilia, satanic politics, the Jeffrey Epstein scandal was the tip of the iceberg, as Sean Stone, the former host of Buzzsaw, lays out the hidden agenda of the dark elite in this 6-part documentary series. In this red pill journey, Stone explores famous cases like the Franklin scandal
MK Ultra, and Monarch programming, the JonBenet Ramsey murder, and even the Son of Sam's case, to connect the dots of a dangerous ideology now driving the philosophy of a transhumanist agenda to remake the human being. As more and more people awaken to these hidden truths, the more rapidly we can rise to take our power back. Unquote. So that's what this series is about. And, you know, I love talking about this kind of stuff. And so, of course. And I am going to, on my end, get my video pulled up here so that I can watch it and listen at the same time and sync it up. So I'm going to do that here real quick. And, yeah, so like I said, I encourage you to go and look it up. Best Kept Secret, Sean Stone. This is Chapter 1. Chapter 1 is called The Beast. And hopefully while y'all are out there listening, you'll eventually call in. And if you want to call in, the number to call is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698, and then press number 1, and that raises your hand in my switchboard and lets me know that you want to talk. If you don't push number 1, then you can just sit back and listen. I won't bring you on, but hopefully you do press 1 and want to talk a little later into the show. Like I said, I think that we should be able to go through about 3 parts of this and then have plenty of time for conversation afterwards. And so I need to pull this up here in my clips to start playing. So this first part, part 1, is 28 minutes 7 seconds. And it's called The Beast, Chapter 1, The Beast. And so I'm going to go ahead and start this. It's 15 minutes after the hour, and crank through some of this stuff. Hopefully I sound okay. I'm still using these new earbuds that I got. They were only $16, these M-Pow Bluetooth earbuds. And hopefully I sound pretty clear. At least I did on Sunday's show. It sounded, I re-listened to my show, and in my opinion, I sounded pretty good, not quite as good as when I used my headset with a good microphone. You know, but that's to be expected, I think, because obviously earbuds, you don't have the microphone right in front of your mouth, but I'm actually pretty impressed with these, but they definitely are a little bit more comfortable to wear. And so long as I'm coming through and you can hear me, then I'm okay with it. And I'll switch over to my headset if I need to. But for now, I'm just going to be using my earbuds, especially since I'm going to be playing clips and stuff anyways. And then when they start to run out of juice a little bit, then I'll switch over to my headset. That sounds like a good plan, right? Right. Okay. So here we go. Stick around. Give this a listen. Pull up the link to it, Best Kept Secret, Part 1, 28 minutes, 7 seconds long. Encourage you to watch the video in synchronization with listening to the broadcast. But if you're sitting in your car, hanging out, maybe you're listening to the show while you're doing some gardening or something and hands-free, so this gives you something that's pretty good to listen to and might be educational or get you thinking while you're doing whatever you're doing out there. So again, we're going to start this off, 28 minutes, 7 seconds, and hopefully we get through parts 1 through 3 tonight, and then we'll talk later. So here we go.
Thank you. In the time before the dark, there was only light. Till the yawning veil fell across the sky, separating space and night, leaving us in awe of the infinite shadow, that behemoth, that monster. But from the waning of the light, our world was formed, another broken, with enough night left to dream by.
You know, when I was a child, I realized that my parents were Buddhists, but I was raised as a Presbyterian. And so I realized that there were two conflicting points of view. In Buddhism, there is no God, there's no beginning, there's no end, there's only timeless nirvana. But in the Presbyterian Christian tradition, there is Genesis. God said, let there be light. How can you combine Genesis with nirvana? Impossible, right? Nope. You can combine it with the multiverse. You see, our universe did have a beginning. Our universe had a big bang. There was a genesis. But our universe is not the only one. It coexists simultaneously with the multiverse of universes, and therefore they are bubbles floating in nirvana. So today we think that string theory is the only theory that can unify the big and the small. And it basically says that everything around us is like music, that everything we see around us is vibrating, and these vibrations correspond to subatomic particles. Subatomic particles are nothing but notes on a tiny vibrating string. What is physics? Physics is the harmony you can write on these vibrating strings. What is chemistry? Chemistry are the melodies you can play on vibrating strings. What is the universe? The universe is a symphony of strings. And then what is the mind of God? The mind of God is cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. So what we see around us is actually an illusion. We're only looking at the tiniest sliver of what actually exists. Our three-dimensional world is not really the world at all. We've been hoodwinked.
If we think of this, this reality is like a television chart, like a holographic television chart. We're only seeing the frequency that that channel operates on. The electromagnetic spectrum is not what we conceive, and yet that's what 0.005%, they say, of what exists in this universe. Visible light is only a fraction of the 0.005%, and that's all we can see. So we are operate on a particular frequency band, just like a radio station in the and a television station in the analog system. But outside of that is an infinity of possibility, an infinity of other forms of life that take a very different form to us. And some of them are just energetic. They don't have a form. They're just awareness. It's interesting that for me, one of the greatest forms of human control is the suppression of the sense of the possible. Because once you have a situation where you have persuaded people that only this is possible, then anything that you're doing outside of that sense of the possible will be rejected by reflex action. They can't be doing that. It's not possible.
Growing up in Hollywood movie sets, I was introduced at a very young age to the mystery of consciousness, because movies, like magic, manipulate our senses, our minds, our feelings. They make us question the very nature of reality. For instance, it takes months, if not years, to create an experience that literally lasts for only a few minutes of your time. Humans, playing fake characters with real emotion, create a self-contained fictional universe that lives on, like a parallel universe, even after you're done watching it. And if you're watching this, then we're having a multidimensional experience of many different timelines all coinciding at this moment. But the director, like a magician, decides what you get to see and where the frame ends. And that's where I want to go. Seven years ago,
I started an interview show called Buzzsaw that was spawned from my work with Tyrell and Jesse Ventura on the TV series Conspiracy Theory.
You guys gotta be kidding me.
I grew up with that term, conspiracy theory, surrounding me.
The Oliver Stone, George Bush connection, Oliver Stone?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, he's their spokesman. Yeah, I mean, you think if anyone had the information that he's got and had a national podium to shout it from, that they'd actually let him do it. No, it's quite clear that he's a disinformation junkie for him.
While I doubt my father worked for the CIA, as a Vietnam veteran, he passionately sought to understand how a system could send hundreds of thousands of young men to be sacrificed. Despite the media reassuring us that the President of the United States is the most powerful man in the world, the decision maker, my father saw a deeper state behind the scenes.
You say you want to end the war, so why don't you?
Change always comes slowly. I pulled out more than half the troops. I'm trying to cut the military budget for the first time in 30 years. I want a volunteer army, but it's also a question of American credibility, our position in the world.
We don't want the war. The Vietnamese don't want the war. So why does it go on?
You should be going, Mr. President. Okay. Please.
You can't stop it, can you? Even if you wanted to. Because it's not you. It's the system. The system won't let you stop it.
I'm your old college kid.
What?
She understood something that's taken me 25 years in politics to understand. The CIA, the mafia, those Wall Street bastards.
Sir?
Beast. 19-year-old kid. She called it a wild animal.
He called that system the Beast, after W.B. Yeats's poem.
But it ends so beautifully ominous. What rough beast. His hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. Yes. His country stands at such a juncture.
And it reminded me of the words of Paul to the Ephesians, "Put on the full armor of God, for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the archons, against the authorities, against the powers of this world's darkness, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." But how did I come to such a metaphysical conclusion? I think my path was similar to that of Ted Gunderson, who was at one time a candidate for director of the FBI.
I retired from the FBI March 1979. At that time, I was in charge of the FBI Los Angeles Division. I had more than 700 personnel under my command.
When I first came out of the FBI, as I said, I came out in 1979, Attorney General Griffin Bell hired me to coordinate security for the Pan American Games. And I came back and started my own international security consulting firm in Los Angeles, California. And I was a consultant for the 84 Olympics in Los Angeles. And one of my first cases that I handled, I was contacted by some of Dr. Jeffrey R. McDonald's doctor friends.
What happens when a narrative takes the place of reality?
The infamous crime happened back in 1970.
Dr. Jeffrey McDonald has been charged with the murders of his pregnant wife and their two young daughters. McDonald blamed the crime on a group of hippies.
Either Jeffrey McDonald slaughtered his family and then tried to hide that fact, or there were intruders imitating the Manson family, including a girl with a floppy hat who attempted to kill him and killed his family.
It's not the kind of guy who does this.
This case had so much publicity. It was on the headlines every day.
The best-selling book, the miniseries,
the television movie, Fatal Vision.
Millions of people saw Jeffrey McDonald killing his family. It solidified people's views about the case.
Does it seem strange to you that no one else has confessed?
It's not really quite accurate to say that no one has confessed.
According to Helena Stokely, I obtained a confession from her on October 25, 1980. I brought her back to L.A. That's a story by and of itself. And Helena Stokely told me that it was her satanic cult group that went into the house that night. And it was her initiation into the group. And I said, what is this all about? And that was really the first I learned about Satanism.
He told Mr. Beasley and me also in 1980 that one of the high priorities in human sacrifice was the pregnant woman for this group. Is that true?
Yes, sir. The firstborn child is very eminent in any type of case like that.
When you say eminent, what do you mean?
It's considered at the top of the list.
For death or for property?
Anything.
Anything you want to be with the child?
Yes, sir.
And I learned that the police intelligence files on this group of Satanists that Alina described by name gave me descriptions of exactly where each one of them went in the house, what happened, step by step. Intelligence files disappeared out of the Fayetteville Police Department files and also out of Waycross, Georgia, because one of them had been arrested down there.
Was the CID undercover agent involved in the murder?
We were thinking there was one member in the immediate cult who could have been an informant for the CID.
I went on national television, a number of national TV shows, and I had people calling me from all over the country, telling me the same basic story, from East Coast to West Coast, North and South. And I had people that, what you'd call them, multi-generation Satanists. That's somebody who was born into it, mother, father, grandfather, grandmother, were involved in Satanism. And adult survivors, that's somebody that gets out, usually has to go into hiding to survive. I had these people call me from all over the country, telling me about the ceremonies and about the extent of the satanic movement in this country today.
Now, for those of you thinking this is Geraldo Rivera's satanic panic, let's be clear. Anton LaVey's Church of Satan was not organizing the pedophilia and daycare centers, rock bands hailing Satan, or Richard Ramirez's murder spree. But those things did happen in the 80s. And as my favorite horror film was telling us, the children were in danger, but the parents were not listening.
No, trust us. It's not you I don't trust, it's just...
being raped by a gun up my vagina with men standing around me masturbating on me. That is not only child abuse. I think that's child abuse perpetrated by a group of people who shared a belief system.
This was what? What was the... What
God
was
knows what it was.
You were how old?
I was less than 5 years old.
There is no such thing as an organized Satanist religion. Satanism by its very nature is indefinable, except its opposition in a radical sense, spiritual opposition to a lot of Christianity and basically all monotheistic faiths.
Please, God.
This is God.
So all of a sudden it becomes a satanic panic. But one of the bases of the narrative is, well, there are all these people out here who believe in this worldwide Satanist conspiracy, okay? Well, which people? What do you mean by a Satanist conspiracy? You know, it's like it sounds woo-woo. It sounds ridiculous.
Shem Ham Farash.
Shem Ham Farash.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
And that became almost a pattern, almost like a drumbeat in the 90s. And it still goes on today, you know. But what's appalling is, you know, it's now become an assumption thanks to organizations like Wikipedia. And a lot of this argument can't really be addressed because all somebody has to do is yell conspiracy. It's like yelling communist. And like thought shuts down.
If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist.
I mean, one of the ironies of this is that when the Catholic Church child abuse scandal with the priest came out, like everybody bought into it. But a lot of the data was basically the same. But it was like, it's okay to see some kind of grand conspiracy in the Catholic Church to abuse children. But when you bring up Satanism, it's like it's all a witch, you know, witch hunt. Well, you could say the same thing about the Catholic Church.
And the Oscar goes to Spotlight.
Organized pedophilia and child abuse, I mean, this is a no-brainer if you talk to law enforcement.
In 1989, I was contacted by a gentleman by the name of Ed Weaver, a wonderful Christian man in Lincoln, Nebraska. But he said, we have a real problem here in Nebraska.
One of the grimmest and most disturbing examples of heinous crimes, institutional corruption, and abuse of political power is said to have occurred back in the mid to late 1980s in the heartland of America. And it is known as the Franklin Conspiracy or the Franklin Cover-Up. The conspiracy involved a child pedophilia ring allegedly involving prominent politicians and business leaders in the Omaha, Nebraska area, with ties leading all the way to some of the most powerful circles in Washington, D.C.
John DeCamp's book on the Franklin scandal itself, the Franklin Cover-Up, I believe it was called, was elucidating because John himself was a former Phoenix operative, if I understand, within the CIA apparatus in Vietnam, working for William Colby, who became CIA director thereafter. So DeCamp is not an uninformed person to have then investigated this in Nebraska and come up with that first book, which I think inspired some of your research and work.
John DeCamp's book inspired me to go out to Nebraska and check it out. Same with Conspiracy of Silence. Conspiracy of Silence was a documentary that was going to be shown on the Discovery Channel in the UK, and its funding was suddenly, the plug was pulled on it.
It's a web of intrigue that starts in our holy of holies, Boys Town, Nebraska, one of the most respected institutions in the United States, and spreads out like a spider web to Washington, D.C., right up to the steps of the nation's capital, the steps of the White House, involves some of the most respected and powerful and richest businessmen in this United States of America, and the centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex and drug dealing and drug couriers, the compromising of politicians, the compromising of businessmen, but worst of all, the corruption of key institutions of government that have the duty and responsibility to make sure these things never happen.
In this particular case, the FBI and the IRS raided the Franklin Credit Bureau, which was a credit bureau established in the minority neighborhood in order to furnish banking and financial opportunities to the minorities. People on the board of directors included people like Harold Anderson, who was past publisher of the Omaha World Herald, other very prominent citizens. And as a result of the raid, there was publicity. Larry King, by the way, was the individual who was president of the savings and loan. Not Larry King, alive CNN, but Larry King, a black man, a fast rising star in the Republican Party, had sung the national anthem in Texas at the Republican National Convention and New Orleans at the Republican National Convention.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
So ultimately, what happened with the Franklin scandal is the Nebraska Senate found out about Lawrence E. King, who was one of the pimps in this pedophile network, and started to dig into this and investigate it. And what happened was the state and both the federal government just came after the senators really, really hard.
I was very disappointed with the way the FBI and law enforcement treated the victims. They, in fact, turned them into the offenders, so to speak. Instead of taking the evidence that was delivered to them by the victims, they seemed to bear down and try to get the victims to change their story.
There was three boys that I had seen at one of the receptions at the country camp in there, and I'm almost positive they were both town boys, almost positive. They were there.
I realized what that look in their eye was back then. It was fear. It was fear of every, you know, I mean, I had witnessed, you know, firsthand things that would, you know, destroy this city, you know, people, a position, you know what I mean? It's not going to be believed, they said. It will not be believed. You will be found guilty of perjury, and you, I mean, they weren't telling me maybe. You know, they were saying, there's no way. You go on with this story, you're going to jail.
The lead investigator of the Senate subcommittee, his plane mysteriously broke up in midair, and he was killed. His son was killed after he'd allegedly uncovered some critical evidence to uncover this pedophile network.
National Transportation Safety Board investigators say wreckage from the crash is apparently strewn over a 3/4 to 1 mile long stretch in this field.
The fact that the wreckage is scattered over a large area certainly demonstrates that it did break up in flight.
I managed to acquire all his investigative reports and all his investigative documentation. I had a list of over 60 victims. And it was up to me to put it all together. I drove around the country looking for victims, and these kids were very, very hard to find. Well, now they're young adults, but a lot of them came from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and they were turned on to drugs. That was a big carrot for these pedophilic pimps, was give the kid drugs, and then so they were turned on to drugs and repeatedly molested. And ultimately, when they reached a point of where they weren't marketable anymore, they were expunged by the networks.
Those perpetrators named by the children formed a ring of rich and powerful pedophiles in Omaha. Men from industry, politics, the media, even the police.
There was a house in Washington, D.C. where a lot of the children were flown to, and then in the house in Washington, D.C., there would be like pedophilic parties, pedophilic orgies. And this house was wired for audiovisual blackmail by a CIA asset named Craig Spence.
And if Washington doesn't have enough to talk about these days, the Washington Times reported today that unidentified White House aides in the Carter, Reagan, and Bush administrations now are being investigated for using the services of a call boy ring.
This is the thing that always bothered me. They claimed it was the largest male prostitution ring in the city that they've ever had uncovered. It was $1 million a year minimum.
Yeah.
And yet they only prosecuted the operator, Henry Vinson, and three of his lieutenants, as it were. Mm-hmm. They never went after any of the Johns, the clients. This operation, which was, again, quite large, claimed to have clients that ran from the White House to the Capitol Hill, to the State House, to the churches, within the media. The prosecutors knew all this stuff. There was approximately 20,000 pieces of or 20,000 documents.
Yes.
That they had. They sealed the entire record when they found out I was accessing it.
Craig Spence was definitely blackmailing upper echelon people in the Reagan and Bush administrations and also senators and congressmen in his home.
Did the D.C. madam ever name names of politicians that were involved or from his black book, for example?
Some of the people he named were William Casey, who was head of the CIA, and Donald Gregg, who was George Herbert Walker Bush's national security advisor when Bush was vice president.
I see prosecutors who are afraid to prosecute. I see politicians who shouldn't be there. I see institutions of government which are rendered ineffective because they've been compromised or corrupted or threatened or whatever. And I said, I don't know what to do. He said, I'm going to tell you what to do. I said, oh, thank goodness. And he says, get as far away from this thing as you can.
I said, you have to consider the possibility of some danger to not only your reputation, but to your person. I mean, there are people do react rather violently to some kinds of charges, or particularly if they're true, there's more apt to be a negative reaction than if they're false. If they're false charges, then they can be reacted to in a normal way, a libel suit or whatever. But if there's truth in it, there can be a danger in that situation. We've seen that happen in other cases.
One of the more famous cases, I think, was Johnny Gosch, and there's been a recent film that you helped produce on the question of who kidnapped Johnny Gosch.
Sunday, September 5th, approximately 6 a.m. 12-year-old John Gosch had been delivering papers in this affluent neighborhood of West Des Moines. That was the last time he was seen.
The parents believe the boy is alive and has been kidnapped.
Johnny, we love you. We're waiting for you to come home. We're doing everything in our power to get you back. Take care, babe.
He was the poster child, the first milk carton kid, if I'm correct, and he basically disappeared in the 1980s, and it turns out that he seems to have been trafficked into the same Nebraska pedophile ring, no?
Yes, Paul Manasseh, who was one of the kids that was enmeshed in this pedophile network, said that he helped abduct Johnny Gosch. And I think if the police and the FBI had given him any credibility whatsoever, they could have probably found Johnny Gosch. But because the FBI was so concerned about covering up Lawrence King's pedophile network, they couldn't give Paul Benassi any credibility. So ultimately, any leads that were gleaned from Paul Benassi were completely ignored by law enforcement.
And Paul Benassi actually sued Larry King, the key figure in the Franklin cover-up, and actually won the suit, and Lawrence King went to prison.
Paul told me and has drawn for me the living quarters of the White House. The public's not allowed in the living quarters of the White House. There's no question in my mind Paul is telling the truth.
Please go ahead and answer all questions.
I was created by a government program.
Which government program?
Monarch.
And what is Monarch?
Monarch is an operation that was created by the United States government to create spies for other countries. They use children for the purpose that they're easily integrated into multiple personalities because they can dissociate. Monarch is a program that is run by Michael Angelo Aquino, who was an Army Reserve Colonel at Presidio. He is also the leader of the Temple of Set. He also runs a child daycare center. He also is involved in human sacrifice.
Paul Benassi was not the only person to claim to have been part of a mind control program directed at creating multiple personalities in children, nor the only one to claim Michael Aquino's involvement.
People who were using Satanism and horrific blood traumas, for example, did not worship Satan per se. That's a religious belief. They're not theologians or scientists to do what they do and to carry it out. And I think a good example of that would be Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino, the founder of the Temple of Set.
The Temple is the only international satanic religious institution fully recognized by the United States government.
They had the satanic rituals going on. There was an altar in there, and all of the graffiti on the wall would indicate that.
How'd you find this place?
This is a fortification during World War II. During World War II, where they had gun batteries.
I can see a pentagram painted on the wall. I can see the words Prince of Darkness. On this wall, I see several inverted crosses and other obvious satanic ritualistic paintings.
He was being trained at the War College for psychological warfare division for being able to implement mind control in the military predominantly, but also through people like myself. He was my primary programmer in MK-Ultra mind control. It was actually being used to control people in a very traumatic manner.
All right, so that was part one, talking about MK-Ultra, Project Monarch, human trafficking, and the deliberate mind control to induce multiple personalities in children. And so we're going to continue to part two, mind control, and so again, this is Best Kept Secret by Sean Stone. This is part two, Mind Control, that I'm going to be pulling up next and crank through this stuff. And again, I will remind you, we're open to discussion during the second half of the show. So if you want to call in, please do so, 563-999-3698. Again, 563-999-3698, and then press number 1, and that raises your hand and lets me know that you want to talk. So, 2, mind control. This is 27 minutes long, and I encourage you to watch the videos as well so that you can see the visuals. You know, conducting some of these interviews with some of these people that are talking about this, victims of it. And good information presented. So here we go with part two, mind control.
Breaking news. Governments are corrupt. They lie to their people, steal from their people, and occasionally kill them. As Americans, we tend to believe this about other governments, but rarely, if ever, our own. One of the most glaring examples of just such violations of American constitutional principles occurred during the height of the Cold War under the moniker MKUltra. It was perhaps the most famous of the CIA mind control programs that engaged 80 institutions, including universities, hospitals, prisons, foundations, and pharmaceutical companies. The experiments were conducted on unwitting U.S. citizens, sometimes leading to permanent mental damage and even death. But here's the kicker. When the operation was finally exposed by Congress in the 1970s, the CIA had already destroyed the vast majority of the documentation on what they had actually done.
The senators seemed unimpressed. Perhaps it was because they already knew too much. Each senator arriving with a fat, orange-colored notebook crammed with classified material about the CIA, all marked top secret.
Basically, a lot of this MKUltra stuff, a lot of the experiments were initially done in concentration camps, like at Dachau and Auschwitz during World War II. And so we happened to get quite a few of these doctors and scientists in the United States to kind of help solidify these mind control programs, as well as programs involving chemical, biological warfare. In 1995, I believe, there was a presidential committee hearing that was headed by a psychiatrist from New Orleans. Her name was Valerie Wolf.
As a therapist for the past 22 years, I have specialized in treating victims and perpetrators of trauma and their families. When word got out that I was appearing at this hearing, nearly 40 therapists across the country, and I had about a week and a half to prepare, contacted me to talk about clients who had reported being subjects in radiation and mind control experiments. The consistency of people's stories about the purpose of the mind control and pain induction techniques such as electric shock, use of hallucinogens, sensory deprivation, hypnosis, dislocation of limbs, and sexual abuse is remarkable.
And if you go back to the Catholic Inquisition, that obviously similarly very well organized. We don't have exact count, but hundreds of thousands of people burned at the stake, driven by an ideology. All in the service of God and so on.
Between the years of 1957 and 1984, I became a pawn in the government scheme, whose ultimate goal was mind control and to create the perfect spy, all for the use of chemicals, radiation, drugs, hypnosis, electric shock, isolation in tubs of water, sleep deprivation, brainwashing, verbal, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse.
And that was true all the last witch was burned at the stake in Scotland in 1797. But then what happened was it got secularized and the authority and the control got transferred to the mental health field. And instead of being witches, these are now a bunch of hysterical women with false memories and false accusations.
To emphasize his point, look no further than the World Federation for Mental Health, whose director at its founding in 1948 was the UK's psychological warfare head, John Rawlings Rees, of the Tavistock Institute in England. Tavistock has a long history of mind control, since its origins in studying shell shock and traumatized World War I veterans. Before taking over the World Federation, Rees had written, "Public life, politics, and industry should all of them be within our, the psychiatrists, sphere of influence. We have done much to infiltrate the various social organizations throughout the country. We have made a useful attack on a number of professions, the teaching profession and the church. I think we must imitate the totalitarians. Let us all, therefore, very secretly, be fifth columnists."
It wasn't a theory anymore if mind control existed or research was being done. A lot of people knew that. Point is that it's operational. They were using it, hence the word, you know, operational mind control.
And of course, out here, I was crazy and alone. You know, nobody knew about this. Nobody believed this. But the closer I got to D.C., the more people knew about it. And you'd meet somebody in D.C. and what are you doing here? And you say, well, I'm doing research for the National Technical Information Service and on mind control and hypnosis and drugs and interrogation and everything. Oh, you're talking about erasing people's memories, somebody would say. The guy across the street mowing his lawn over there, he's one of them, you know. So it was like everywhere in Washington.
Walter Bowert became a figure in the 1960s counterculture when he founded the East Village Other, a newspaper that gave voice to Allen Ginsberg, Abby Hoffman, Marsha McLuhan, and Timothy Leary. Leary introduced Bowert to Peggy Mellon Hitchcock, an heiress to the Mellon family, and Billy Mellon Hitchcock, who was bankrolling the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, a mass distributor of Leary's and the CIA's drug of choice, LSD. Bowert soon found himself investigating something that wouldn't be exposed to the public until the 1975 Church Committee.
There appears to be no report by the CIA to higher authority of the existence of these toxins or biological weapons.
Eventually, we start doing the research as he did. He found out that this is far more insidious than he thought because of all the children that were missing, and the fact that this was an inbred, long-term, generational operation where people would actually have children for the mere purposes of donating those children into what he referred to as the cryptocracy. And this was this hidden hand behind the orchestrators and the people that finance this country, the banks, the hidden hand that have been here in the very beginning, that are doing all this, and they're involved with the harvesting of our own children.
I was born in 1956 in a generational Illuminati family.
And tell us, what does that mean? So did your parents talk about this when you were young? They talked about their lineage and what was their belief system?
Their belief system was basically the old religion of Molech, and it's a mind control religion. It's a religion based on ceremonial abuse of children in the programmable state from 1 to 7 years old.
What Jay Parker is describing is often called monarch programming, intended to create dissociative states within traumatized youth. My father inadvertently hinted at it in his film, Natural Born Killers.
Now, one minute I'm walking with my mother, and all of a sudden, chest explodes. She hits the ground, right? And I'm just looking at her. Her forearm flies off, her hip explodes, and I'm not hearing any shots, right?
Boom!
Chest explodes, right?
When asked about Monarch being a sub-project of MKUltra, former CIA Director William Colby is alleged to have said that it was stopped between the late 60s and early 70s, but with no paper trail to prove its existence. I was not surprised by Michael Aquino's response when I asked him about Monarch.
Were you ever familiar with the Monarch project, or so-called Monarch sub-project of MKUltra?
Well, the Monarch program, as far as I'm concerned, is nothing more than an urban myth.
With a background in the CIA's Phoenix program during the Vietnam War, which was centered around assassinations, torture, and psychological black operations, could Aquino be trusted to tell the truth? The producers of the Cook Report certainly didn't seem to think so.
Army investigators here at the Presidio base in San Francisco have now formally accused him of ritually abusing young children from the base's daycare center. Indeed, one young girl says she was horribly abused by both Michael and Lilith Aquino at their nearby home.
A U.S. Army chaplain made an accusation of child molestation centering on us at the Presidio of San Francisco at a time when my wife and I were living 3,000 miles away in Washington, D.C.
But we have a copy of the police report, and the child appears to have identified you.
That's not true.
But as the police report shows, and the Aquinos know full well, the victim of that attack did identify them both as her abusers, to her parents, to her therapist, and to the Army. What's more, since that original disclosure, at least 5 other children have made identical allegations.
Now, it's important to emphasize the fact that Colonel Michael Aquino actually sued the United States Army to take his name off of the Criminal Investigations Division's CID's list of alleged child molesters from the Presidio scandal. And he lost. Now, what's so interesting is, of course, in 1983, before that period of time, the Virginian County Police were asked to make an inquiry into the leaders of the Temple of Set. And they came up with some surprising facts. Aquino, of course, was an expert in the techniques of psychological warfare, a skill that was to prove useful to him in more ways than one. What happened was it was unveiled, and with what I already knew became public knowledge, he held a high-level international security clearance. He was on second mint to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and he was a member of the World Affairs Council. Now, what happened was the Virginian inquiry uncovered the fact that 12 other leading lights in the Temple of Set were U.S. Army intelligence officers.
Aquino and his fellow intelligence operatives within the Temple of Set demonstrate a clear link between occultism, which means hidden knowledge, and mind war. Isn't that the very essence of magic, to manipulate the mind?
To me, this is where the darkness comes from. This is the CIA's operations, Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra. These were cynical manipulations of human consciousness, disregarding any ethical or moral considerations. The idea of probing the human mind, probing the psyche, wiping out memories, replacing them with other memories, hypnotizing people, getting them to take certain types of psychotropic drugs, convincing them to commit, you know, assassinations and then forget all about it, to carry out clandestine operations and then have no memory of it later. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know, from Fantasia. You know, all those brooms dancing and then suddenly getting out of control. That to me was what, you know, these programs were like. You're actually causing initiatory states to take place. You're initiating people, but without the safeguards of initiation.
How do you explain to people that this is something that is real in terms of the ritual abuse of victims that basically creates what's called multiple personality or dissociative identity? And how oftentimes these memories can be suppressed and they're not just false memories, essentially, as oftentimes the media labels it.
So how have human beings treated human beings for the last 100,000 years, but particularly the last 100 years? So then it goes straight to Nazi Germany. That's obviously a very organized group of people. They murdered at least 6 million people. They tortured people. It was very systematic. They did all these medical experiments, and including these atrocious medical experiments on children. And these are like regular, you know, Caucasian, Western European civilized people.
I was going to ask you, speaking of Nazi Germany, I heard that you, during your time in the military, I think, conducted the Temple of Set ritual at the Revelsberg Castle, where Himmler's SS used to have their meetings, right? It was sort of their secret, their headquarters, right? Their secret castle. Is that correct? You conducted a ritual there?
Yes, that would have been in 1982. It's generally referred to as the Revelsberg Working. In fact, most of the SS never came near the Revelsberg. It was a pet project of Heinrich Himmler's, and it was oriented towards the Grail. It would have been very fascinating to see how that all transpired if, in fact, the SS and Himmler had survived the war and he'd been allowed to continue with it. But then I think you would have seen something dramatically different, a little bit, as I said, more towards the exploration of the human soul from a meditative standpoint than the sort of comic book characters that you normally see of it.
The Grail is mine, and you're going to get it for me.
Shooting me won't get you anywhere.
You know something, Dr. Jones? You're absolutely right.
Heinrich Himmler was studying the black arts and trying to understand more about the effect on the person's mind that is exposed to these blood rituals and sort of thing. What, amazingly enough, Colonel Aquino found out that this was a wonderful trauma base for controlling people's minds.
Liar!
Aquino's admiration for Himmler, a man devoted to breeding pure Aryan supermen, can be understood by their shared fascination with occultism. Some have argued that the entire structure of Nazism was occult, rooted in myth, secretive hierarchy, and propaganda, mind control. After the war, many of those Nazi doctors, scientists, and intelligence officers were brought to work for the U.S. government. In fact, the godfather of the CIA, and of the MKUltra program, Alan Dulles, personally intervened to make sure Himmler's chief of staff was never prosecuted at Nuremberg.
The tribunal sits in judgment upon 20 leaders of the Nazi Party.
The Nazi conspirators continued espousal and exploitation of this master race doctrine.
With the excuse of fighting a Cold War against communism, the American deep state aped the Nazi tactics.
All over the world, we know, it's well established, the State Department and intelligence agencies engage in theater, and it's what they do, it's spycraft, to create spectacles and events that people may not realize are spectacles and events, but that, well, like the overthrow of Mossadegh in the 50s in Iran. They'll funnel money to protesters, they'll, you know, fly people in to infiltrate protesters, they'll create fake newspapers, and so on.
One story that is continuing to alarm citizens around the country, the mysterious appearance, get this, pile of bricks literally being stationed near the sites where these protests and riots ultimately become. They're staging it.
We know that infiltrators by the police, NYPD, they've been documented, or other police forces, dress up like people they're not and provoke violence. Why is it unthinkable that there might be spectacles that might drive an outcome in the news stream? If laws have made it legal to assassinate American citizens, illegal to propagandize them, why should it be crazy or weird to think that that might be for a reason, right? As a journalist, to say these words, just, I can't tell you with what a heavy heart I say them, but we've entered an era in which it is not crazy to assess news events to see if they're real or not real. And in the United States as well as overseas. And in fact, it's kind of crazy not to.
Okay. Do you think that the U.S. military has a sanctioned program for creating serial killers?
Everybody, come on, ridiculous.
Well, wait a minute. What do you think basic training is?
The military.
You take an ordinary guy and turn him into somebody who kills a whole lot of people.
If you ladies leave my island, if you survive recruit training, you will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war.
There's nothing like mysterious or zombie about that. So that you can train people up to do all kinds of different tasks.
Didn't mommy and daddy show you enough attention when you were a child?
And then when you go to the CIA documents and other documents surrounding this guy, G.H. Esterbrooks, who was a professor at Colgate College in New York, describes in great detail, first published in 1943, last time he published this was 1971, on contract to the War Department in the Second World War, creating Manchurian Candidate, artificial multiple personality, and running them operationally.
I was used in black ops, horrific black ops operations out of the Pentagon and the White House, like under Dick Cheney, under George Bush, under the Clintons.
So talk about how does that program work, essentially. I mean, you could basically, it's almost a type of hypnosis, you could call it, in a sense where if you could, you yourself, if given certain triggers, right, whether it was its words or signs or things that you might actually literally go out into an altered state, or you would check out, you know, you wouldn't be consciously aware of your actions?
Well, when I was sexually abused from birth, I had my brain compartmentalized that memory. Even though I couldn't think to make a judgment on it, my brain compartmentalized that memory. So the compartmentalization of memory that I had was already in place. And they knew that by traumatizing me further, it would create more and more and more compartments in my brain. Within those compartments, whenever trauma occurs, the brain photographically records events surrounding trauma. When a horrific accident occurs and people can see the, go back and see the license tags and, you know, whatever. It's the way our brains function, and they know this. So then when trauma, they would traumatize me or torture me, and program information in, like a message to a different global leader. And then that it was like sealed with a code word or a code theme. And then it was accessed on the other end accordingly. And this was how the groundwork for NAFTA was ultimately put into place. I was used heavily in that for the human trafficking and drug operations.
As you all have discussed earlier, I'm sure, there are codes, keys, and triggers that are necessary for someone to know in order to access, very much like getting into a computer program, in order to access the mind of one of these programmed individuals, such as Kathy was. But contained within the pages of this book, well, it was much more than codes, keys, and triggers. Matter of fact, there were very few codes, keys, and triggers in here. What was important, though, were offshore bank account numbers, numbers of persons high up in politics, like Bill Clinton. And at the time that I got this book, Bill Clinton was only running for the office of president.
After 1989, President Bush said, and it's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order.
I didn't realize that he had been destined to be placed in that office.
If you look at the bits and pieces of her story, but if you just look at the pictures from Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, that's enhanced interrogation. But it's the same thing as mind control or brainwashing. So we just, again, sanitized the vocabulary. So, yeah, Kathy O'Brien's story is, some of the details are little up there compared to most people's stories in terms of powerful politicians and so on being directly involved with her. But if you subtract off the powerful politicians part, hundreds, thousands of people have described these kind of things.
There's a case in point where back around 1997, when I was living in Olympia, Washington, an MKUltra survivor from Nebraska contacted me and asked if my wife and I could safe house this woman who was running away from the mob.
Unless you play ball.
God, you people work just like the mob. Yeah, there's no difference.
And the mob was very much into this type of MKUltra type programming, and I guess they had a deal with the government where they could sort of like timeshare these individuals because, you know, they were multifaceted. They could do a number of things. They could do drug running, prostitution, assassinations. So my wife and I actually helped this one woman, and this woman was allegedly involved in an assassination of Luis Donaldo Colosio, who was the presidential candidate of Mexico in 1994. And she had no memory the day before, the day of, the day after. But she has a lot of facts about what happened. And she has no idea why she has all this information stored in her head. It was just such a crazy time because we had all this surveillance around our house. Cars parked in front, the dreaded black helicopters going over our house, hovering over to the house, so our house was shaking, and actual spotlights sometimes even coming onto our house. Basically, we're just saying that, you know, we're here.
Now, for those having a hard time believing mob bosses and government officials share presidential models or sex kittens, remember Marilyn.
Mr. President, the late Marilyn Monroe.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
She may not have worked as a spy, but she took secrets about the government and mafia conspiring to assassinate Castro to the grave. And that was before the CIA colluded with mobsters to smuggle heroin from the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam era. In the 80s, you could still expose these kinds of things on mainstream news, shows like Morton Downey Jr.
When you brought up the fact that you were going in to see General Khun Sa, and that he indeed had been shipping and is shipping 1,200 tons of heroin every year into the United States of America. And we had an opportunity to make a deal. We turned it down. Is that right? That's exactly it, Warren. It was most disturbing to me because we didn't go to see Khun Sa about drugs. We went in cooperation with the White House. Tom Harvey, a would-be Ollie North lookalike, was the NSC staffer that asked us to go. It was to find prisoners of war that reportedly Khun Sa was holding. When we got there, we found out that he had no prisoners, but we couldn't leave without asking him why he insisted on shipping this poison into the world. And Kunsaw said that the U.S. had been his best customer for more than 20 years. Well, I didn't believe it. This was December of 1986. He said that he was willing to stop 900 tons in 1987, and then he said, I will disclose every U.S. government official that I have dealt with in the last 20 years.
The CIA was so heavily involved in CIA cocaine ops that they finally, you know, the people demanded something be done, and finally they investigated themselves to find out they weren't involved. But nevertheless, they were.
Now, it is alleged the CIA also helped the Contras raise money for arms by introducing crack cocaine into California. It is an appalling charge. It is an appalling charge that goes to the heart of this country. It is a charge that cannot go unanswered. It says that the CIA, the agency of the United States government, founded to protect Americans, helped introduce drugs and poison into our children and helped kill their future. No one who heads a government agency, not myself or anyone else, can let such an allegation stand.
I will tell you, Director Deutsch, as a former Los Angeles police narcotics detective, that the agency has dealt drugs throughout this country for a long time. I was personally exposed to CIA operations and recruited by CIA personnel who attempted to recruit me in the late 70s to become involved in protecting agency drug operations in this country.
The secret knowledge equals power. And again, that's going right back into the whole occultism and MKUltra mind control basis and philosophy. The handful of criminals implementing the New World Order. So we're taking over the drug industry worldwide and the drug wars. And that was being used to fund the New World Order. That and human trafficking.
All right, so that was part two. And of course, we'll move on to part three. Part three is 23 minutes long, and so that should fit in nicely. And hopefully you all call in after this part, 23 minutes, and then call in and we'll have some discussion, 563-999-3698, and then press number 1, and that lets me know that you want to talk. So far, I don't see anybody in the chat, and I don't see anybody on the switchboard. So keep me company after this clip. Otherwise, I can continue going. I can continue with part four because I don't like sitting around just talking to myself. I don't do this just to hear my own voice. So I encourage you to call in if you're out there and you're listening. The Best Kept Secret Part 3 is up next, and I'm queuing the video up on my end as well, and hopefully it loads up. Part 3 is called Compromise, and continues on about human trafficking, pedophilia, satanic politics, mind control, and these experiments and corruption and government collusion into it. This past part was talking about the basically free-for-all with importing all these drugs because, of course, part of the mind control is the use of all these drugs. And then go figure if you bring that into the mainstream population combined with the mainstream media and social media. All of this could explain quite a lot about the mentality of the people nowadays, not just here in the United States, but around the world. and would certainly explain the high level of compliance on a scale that we've never seen before, I think, around the world. We haven't seen compliance and obedience to our governments and corporations, and it's mind-blowing, especially here in the United States. So let's continue on, because now we're getting into parts of this that I have not seen. And so I am watching the video in addition to listening to the audio, which I encourage you guys to do. You can find the link to the first part on my show episode link. And from there, you can find all six parts on that channel that I have this on. The channel is The Lost Fallen, or The Last Fallen. Anyway, so that way you can watch these videos and see these interviews and the people that they're talking about. And then they also use a few movie clips and things. And so I definitely encourage you to, when you have some time, go back and look up these videos and give them a watch. And we can continue on here now. So again, Best Kept Secret Part 3 by Sean Stone is the next clip that I'm going to play. So here we go. We'll come back around in 23 minutes.
First of all, our mission is to educate the public in this country and abroad that this is happening. It's happening everywhere, that there are over 27 million children, women and children and men that are in slavery today. But within the United States, there are 200,000 children that end up in the sex trade every year. So it's the fastest growing criminal industry in the world, but it's organized crime. And that's the scary part, because organized crime does work with government. Now, there's a lot of money in this. It's over a $34 billion industry worldwide. And that number is actually low. If you ask the Department of Justice, they would tell you it's $84 billion. If you add in pornography and everything that children are taken and used for. So it's a business. To get it into drug trafficking, you need cash. To get into child trafficking, you only need a child.
The foreign minister of Mexico said to me something that stuck and reverberated for months. And he said to me, you know, you Americans are a bunch of hypocrites. You buy our drugs, you sell us your weapons, and now you're stealing our children. I decided to investigate the issue. And so I went to Mexico. I spent about a year and a half, almost 2 years, and I found that this one Mexican girl had been trafficked from San Miguel de Tenancingo to New York to Palm Beach. During that investigation, I find the Jeffrey Epstein case. Well, the Jeffrey Epstein case, of course, takes me into a whole different direction, because not only are we now talking about a man who is a very wealthy American man. He is a hedge fund manager. He, at the time, was a well-known Wall Street financier, worth allegedly $2 billion. And his case, when I start to investigate, had over two dozen kids that had reported to the police sexual abuse by him and by a number of procurers. One of the alleged procurers, her name is Ghislaine Maxwell, she procured underage girls for Epstein. And she is friendly enough where she was invited to Chelsea Clinton's wedding. Another enormous red flag was raised by the number of politicians that Epstein donated. Epstein is a very generous donor. He's a very generous donor to the Democratic Party, that he donated over $3.5 million to the Clintons. And according to one report, he donated $50,000 to Hillary Clinton in 2006. This was after his indictment.
Really?
Yes. Why did she not return it?
Mm-hmm. Hillary, I have to ask you a question that has been plaguing me for a while. How did you kill Jeffrey Epstein?
A politician has to be very concerned with where their donations are coming from, because they will come back to bite them. I think that is why the Department of Justice under George Bush II administration, when Alberto González was the Attorney General, I think that's why they silenced the case. And in fact, when I spoke to Attorney General González, I mean, this seemed like an open and shut case. Why did you negotiate? And you know what his answer was? We didn't want to make a political mess.
When I first interviewed Conchita Sarnoff in 2015, she was one of the first intrepid journalists to pursue the Epstein story when no mainstream media would touch it. But she was not the only one finding roadblocks.
I've had the story for 3 years. I've had this interview with Virginia Roberts. We would not put it on the air. First of all, I was told, who's Jeffrey Epstein? No one knows who that is. This is a stupid story. Then the palace found out that we had her whole allegations about Prince Andrew and threatened us a million different ways. We were so afraid we wouldn't be able to interview Kate and Will that also quashed the story. And then Alan Dershowitz was also implicated in it because of the plane. So she told me everything. She had pictures. She had everything. She was in hiding for 12 years. We convinced her to come out. We convinced her to talk to us. It was unbelievable what we had. Clinton. We had everything. I tried for 3 years to get it on to no avail, and now it's all coming out, and it's like these new revelations, and I freaking had all of it. I'm so pissed right now. Like, every day I get more and more pissed because I'm just like, oh my God, what we had was unreal.
When Epstein was finally arrested on federal sex trafficking charges in 2019, we were told he killed himself in his cell while on suicide watch.
Routine activities inside of the jail was what you practice, and that's how the guy got time to hang himself.
And the guards just mysteriously went to sleep.
They were profoundly overworked. I mean, I think we know that.
But in the end, he obviously didn't kill himself, just like Jeffrey Epstein. Shut up! I know he's your friend, but I don't care.
The death of Jeffrey Epstein was the red pill moment for millions of people. A reported billionaire with powerful benefactors who used hidden cameras to potentially blackmail his elite clients, some of whom he flew to a private island on a so-called Lolita Express.
He was released in July. Within months, by December of 2010, you went to stay with him at his New York mansion. Why? Why were you staying with a convicted sex offender?
Right. I have always... ever since this has happened, and since this has become, as it were, public knowledge that I was there, I've questioned myself as to why did I go, what was I doing, and was it the right thing to do? And that was the conversation, coincidentally, that was photographed, which was when I said to him, I said, look, because of what has happened, I don't think it is appropriate that we should remain in contact. And by mutual agreement during that walk in the park, we decided that we would part company, and I left, I think it was the next day.
You said you went to break up the relationship, and yet you stayed at that New York mansion several days. I'm wondering how long...
But I was doing a number of other things while I was there.
But you were staying at the house of
yes?
a convicted sex offender.
It was a convenient place to stay.
When I went and looked at edge.org, which you can find out was a multi-billionaire club of people that was financed by Jeffrey Epstein. You can go to edge.org today, look up under people, and go to G. You'll see Bill Gates on there as a contributing member of that organization. Marina Abramovich is on there. Paul Allen was on there. All the heads of major industries were on there. These people don't give a shit about anybody, and they get up there and they smile in front of you, and they are infiltrated throughout all of our institutions, including government. They own the politicians, right and left. What we are going to find out very soon is that there aren't Democrats and Republicans in the United States government. There's a unified cabal of controlled people who serve these powers, and they keep the theater going for you and I to run back and forth and vote every 4 years.
The centerpiece of Epstein's Island looks like a temple and features a grand piano, which leaves one imagining eyes wide shut parties. Until all the clues and witnesses come out, the Epstein case leaves more questions than answers, because we have barely seen the iceberg's tip.
Children are often used as the commodity, a way to buy yourself into certain inner circles. And these people are all wealthy, they're all powerful, and they don't trust you unless you're as compromised as they are.
Maybe it's time to look at the mainstream sexualization of children since the 1990s in that light. Especially when some people wonder if Ghislaine Maxwell was spotted in the background of a photo with JonBenet Ramsey.
It was Christmas night, 1996, and inside this Colorado home, a murder took place that shocked the world.
JonBenet Ramsey.
The JonBenet's murder.
JonBenet Ramsey.
JonBenet Ramsey was just 6 years old when she died. In the 25 years she's been gone, there's been endless speculation about who did it. Some say it was her mother.
Of all of the evidence left behind, that ransom note is the most baffling.
Reporter Diane Diamond has covered the story from the beginning. She says the author of the ransom note seemed to know a lot about the family. The demand for $118,000 was close to the exact amount of John Ramsey's bonus that year.
A ransom note is not that long. A ransom note says, I have your child, I want $1 million, I'll call you later.
After the grand jury did its work in 1998 and 1999 for 13 months, in October of 99, the grand jury finished its work. The district attorney held a big press conference and basically said, we're not going to indict anybody in this case, and we're going to seal the grand jury report forever.
The Boulder grand jury has completed its work and will not return. No charges have been filed.
And now to a shocking update. In the case of JonBenet Ramsey, the 6-year-old beauty queen who was found dead on Christmas Day in her home in Colorado. A brand new report reveals that the grand jury in that case had voted to indict both of her parents in the case for child abuse leading to her death.
The case, the investigation had cost around $2 million. The public was obviously very interested in this. So it raised the questions of, you know, why, what's in the grand jury report? And why is it not going to be released? We're going to release 4 pages, which were essentially 4 paragraphs. And we're going to keep the other 14 pages sealed. And those 4 paragraphs said, we're indicting John and Patsy Ramsey on 2 counts, neither count being murder. The first count is basically child endangerment. You exposed your daughter to the person or persons that resulted in her death. That was count 4. Count 7 said, and then you participated in the aftermath of the crime and helping to cover up the crime.
And also, one has to wonder, what is in the other 14 pages that were not released? Are there names? A Boulder police detective that is retired now that worked on the case, when Steve interviewed him, he said, this case is not about what you think it is. Is that?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And I was pushing him to try and say anything, and it was difficult, but he said, you know, I was working on a case a couple of years ago. It involved a city official in Boulder. I got too close to it, and they just pulled me off of it. We were told by somebody who worked or was in contact with somebody who worked for the Boulder Daily Camera that they actually had a list of people in the city government that you just kept your hands off of. We don't investigate these people. We don't write about them, and they're hands off.
This was a child of a Lockheed Martin executive, an $18 billion a year firm with Pentagon and top secret clearance across the world, and with this huge multi-million dollar security apparatus, an entire protocol unfolds, and the interface between the head of Lockheed Martin Security and the FBI is elaborate, and it's interlocking, and nobody from either of those units came near that crime scene. What you are looking at here is something so irregular, so impossible, there can only be one answer, that this was a domestic, personal, aberrational crime of some kind, or in any case a crime which, though located inside a home, may have had repercussions outside in terms of circles of people who would not want to investigations going on about child pornography, child abuse, or child sexuality.
During the day that your child was found and in the days following, Mr. Ramsey, there were reports from the police that you didn't seem distraught. You weren't sobbing. You seemed stoic. It was said you two rarely talked to each other. To them, this made it look as if you were guilty.
I've heard that, and I find that unbelievable.
The Crime Stoppers' phones were manned by volunteers. My cubicle happened to be right next to the Crime Stopper door, and somebody called with a tip on the JonBenet Ramsey case, and the call taker panicked because it was a pretty serious call. Comes out of the room, and he asked me to take the call, so I did, and this is what I remember from 25 years ago. A real stern voice starts out with, "Listen carefully." I've already repeated this once. "Listen carefully," I think were the first words. This JonBenet was killed accidentally during a pedophile sexual ritual. And she was killed accidentally by a garrote. But the point was, at the time, still to this day, is the press had not released anything about any kind of pedophile ring or anything along that line, or the garrote. That had not been mentioned in the press. The public was not aware of that.
Boulder police went to court today to try to keep secret the report of the autopsy performed on the body of JonBenet. They were opposed by lawyers representing news organizations.
Look, she had a torn hymen and she had vaginal bruising. That does not mean sexual abuse. It could be child molestation. I mean, she could have been masturbating. It could have been a bicycle. There could have been lots of stuff.
Okay.
It's not sexual abuse. Don't prove it.
Well, okay. Well, I'll take it back to this extent, Larry. It could be.
There were clearly people in Boulder with some knowledge of these kinds of parties and these kinds of activities. This is not the kind of thing you want to come forward to the police and say, "I know that this is being done with children," because there's legal exposure around that if you know too much, et cetera. And the most suspicious character in that whole subculture from the very beginning was JonBenet's primary personal and pageant photographer. And so when we spoke to the pageant mothers, it set off all kinds of alarms, because in the immediate aftermath of the crime, he was calling them up after midnight, screaming and crying, saying, "I did not kill JonBenet. I did not kill JonBenet." The arc of that story sort of completes itself, from being hysterical right after the murder started to being, "He told me, you know, I know more, but I'm never going to tell you what I know about this case," to very odd behavior, to moving out of the area and then getting busted for child porn.
As though the case were not mysterious enough, an anonymous poem was sent to the Boulder police in the 2000s entitled "The Manchurian Doll," styled after W.B. Yeats' Second Coming, referring to the beast. "The Antichrist lurks in the head, it festers in the carnal eye, which takes young victims from their bed to suffer that and then to die. Another Manchurian candidate is dead."
I'm sure that JonBenet Ramsey was being groomed in the entertainment industry, and her death happened on Christmas, which is another event that Satanists use to do their sexual orgies. So what happened was, the last news conference was on October 13th, 1999. We were given a file of 23 pages of affidavits and FBI memos. And so from what I gathered from the information I got is that JonBenet Ramsey was connected to a case. It involved a case of a young child being abused during satanic rituals in Texas.
You're saying that they were sort of a network, the same network of people, so it was more than just the parents? I mean, you're saying the parents were like involved in some network that was like, was it prostituting the daughter because she was a beauty queen? Was that the idea?
From the information I got from Lee Hill and a number of people, there was a woman that came to Boulder, said she had been abused by one of the Ramsey's close friends, Fleet White.
It was at Fleet White's Christmas party that JonBenet was taken the night before her murder. when the 6-year-old cryptically spoke of a planned meeting with Santa Claus later on Christmas night. Though best friends for years, the Ramseys and Whites had a permanent falling out at JonBenet's funeral. Fleet White Jr. and his father, a wealthy and powerful oil man, might indicate the gateway into a strange world, as they were accused by Nancy Krebs of molesting her when she was a child.
And she was giving testimony, and I knew the attorney that was safe housing her. And anytime anybody would try to venture toward the realm of pedophilia or ritual child abuse, they would get threatened.
In testimony similar to Paul Bonacci's, a young Aryan-looking boy named Nicholas Schultz identified Michael and Lilith Aquino as perpetrators in his abuse, which involved a neo-Nazi group his father belonged to, the White Eagle Lodge. In this world, increasingly looking like Twin Peaks, it gets stranger.
Have either of you fellows heard of a place called the White Lodge?
Cooper, you may be fearless in this world, but there are other worlds.
Schultz was allegedly abducted by this group to a castle in Sedalia, Colorado, belonging to the ex-wife of a CIA officer named Merritt Ruddock. Ruddock's role in the CIA? He was deputy to Frank Wisner, the man in charge of recruiting Nazis in the post-war era, and the CIA officer in charge of Operation Mockingbird, a program to buy journalists and influence American media.
Yeah, it was said, you know, that the leadership, the so-called Star Chamber, was, you know, mainly CIA, U.S. Army, and I think Air Force people who were leading it. All these surface-level groups that, you know, seemed somewhat connected to the stuff, but also seemed, you know, legitimate enough on the surface. I think that what really goes on is that you have an underground cult, basically, you know, tied with these intelligence services, and that it's, you know, basically, you know, sort of stealing ideology from all these other groups, and it's sort of turning it into this weird Frankenstein monster, and of you know, an ideology that becomes the guiding light of, you know, how of all of these covert operations that go on, whether it's these terrorist cells or whether it's human trafficking or drug trafficking. It, you know, it has a lot in common with things that we've seen before, and yeah, I agree that this could be part of, you know, finally explaining a lot of what really goes on behind the scenes and, you know, under the surface of what happens in our country.
I didn't know if the child was crazy or if that was just, if there was just a lot of this and I was naive.
Well, the thing that you mentioned to me the last time I talked to you is that he was on, they drugged your child. I think.
Yeah, they had him drugged.
They had him drugged. So then you, under drugs, you can dress up like the bunny rabbit, you can dress up like
right. An
alien.
Right.
And the child can say, you know,
I'm assuming
he was, you know, yes, abused by an alien or a bunny rabbit or something.
And I knew that. And that's why we didn't really push that. We got the father convicted on child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
We could prove that the child had been raped 7 ways from Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that he saw some stuff. How much of that was accurate information from that 5-year-old, we don't know. And Nicholas,
that's one.
You and I, Nicholas, seems to believe that he knows George Bush Sr. And they didn't put that in there. But they did put in Jerry J. Moore, whom Nicholas has never identified and talked about.
So Nicholas has identified George Bush Sr.?
I don't know. He seems to think he knew him.
Part of the problem of what we have with people in power right now, they're all compromised. You know? And the only way, it's like the Working Class Hero song by John Lennon, there's room at the top, they're telling you still, but first you must learn how to smile as you kill if you want to be like the folks on the hill.
But first you must learn how to smile as you kill if you want to be like the folks on the hill.
For ourselves and for future generations, a new world order. A world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations.
Boy, that one went fast, didn't it? So here we are. There is 1 hour, 17 minutes left of the live broadcast. And so if you want to call in and keep me company, I encourage you to do so, 563-999-3698. Again, 563-999-3698. I did only plan to play the first three parts of the six tonight to allow time during the second half of the show here for people to call in and chat and discuss stuff. And seems nobody is around. What's going on? Where is everybody? Everybody's out and about. Maybe everybody's kind of taking advantage of the last month of summer now that we're into August. I could go ahead and play part four. I'll give a little bit of time here just to see if anybody shows up on the switchboard or in the chat room. Because again, like I said, I don't like just sitting here just talking to myself. So call in. Keep me company. I'm lonely. Where is everybody? Where's Joey? Joe, call in on Sunday. Where are you today? Where is he? I don't know if he's mad at me for some reason. What? It's a mystery. So, Donnie, he's out there. Everybody that usually knows I do these Wednesday specials, call in. Where are you? Bianchi, call in. Nathan, call in. Donnie, Cinnamon, Frank, Naj, anybody, call in. We'll give it a few minutes here to see if anybody decides to show up. If not, then I'll continue with part four. Let's see, what have I posted that I want to talk about? Definitely lots of stuff going on in the news that we could discuss. Let's see. Just in the headlines, Trump's purported free speech social media platform, Truth Social, is hiding user posts and threatening to create curated echo chamber, research group finds. And you know what? I can actually attest to this. Because here's the thing. I am on Truth Social. And I just haven't spent much time in it recently because people have followed me. I have followed other people. And I was posting, at least my show episodes, and I was posting some of my articles, kind of testing it out. And I'm, literally getting no likes, no responses, no nothing. And I'm going through the feed in Truth Social, and I don't see anything from the people. If I go directly, to their profile page, I can see their posts. They've been posting. But I don't see it in my feed. And so I'm really seriously not very impressed with Truth Social. And I know several people that have absolutely loved it. They think it's the greatest thing. And yet my experience of it is this is a waste of time. Why should I waste my time posting about stuff and following people only to never see their posts, only for nobody to ever see my posts? So it just really does seem like there's some preferential treatment going on with Truth Social where they are suppressing posts. And pretty disappointing because I know that a lot of people were hoping that Truth Social would be a good alternative. But in my experience, it really hasn't been. So, hopefully I didn't offend anybody out there, but if I did, well, I'm just speaking the truth here from my experience. You can argue with me if you want. Maybe your experience is different. Maybe somehow you're more liked, or I don't know. But every time I go there, it is just a really boring feed. I'm just scrolling and scrolling, and I see posts from, news organizations and stuff, those show up, because I follow, Epoch Times and things. But I'm not seeing posts from actual people that I follow. It makes no sense. So if they really want to get True Social off the ground, they need to get some smarter developers on the case and truly make it so that the posts you see are the ones you actually follow first. And if people are following you, then they should be able to see your posts. Otherwise, it's a huge waste of time to even bother posting it. Because why post if nobody's going to see it? And why follow people when you're never going to see their posts? So I'm just saying. Let's see. There's so much else that we can talk. But I don't want to sit here and talk to myself. If nobody's listening, what's the point? Same thing with True Social, right? Why spend your time posting if nobody's going to see it? And same thing with me, like, doing this radio show, you know, I want to talk to people. I want to talk with people. I want to hear what other people have to say. I want to have conversations. So I don't want to sit here and spend 3 hours just talking to myself and hearing my own voice and nobody's around to hear it, right? The only time I like doing that is like singing in the shower or something. Nobody hears me when I screw up the lyrics or my voice cracks or I run out of breath or, you know, there's nobody or, you know, nobody around to hear my singing or my attempts at singing. That's all the better for me, but not when it comes to doing radio shows. So since there is nobody in the switchboard right now, nobody's in the chat room, it seems like everything that I'm saying here is in vapor space. I'm going to go ahead and queue up part 4, which I did not plan on doing tonight. But may as well, right? The Best Kept Secret, Chapter 4, New World Order. This is by Sean Stone. Again, this is the son of Oliver Stone that did this documentary. And so I'm going to go ahead and play it. And hopefully anybody out there that's listening will call in and we can have some conversation afterwards. There is 1 hour and 9 minutes left of the live broadcast to call in, 563-999-3698. And then press number 1 to raise your hand and let me know that you'd like to talk. The chat room is also open. So hopefully somebody out there decides to call in. All right, so here we go. This is The Best Kept Secret, Part 4. This one is 26 minutes, 40 seconds long. And here we go.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order. A world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order.
But what you're saying is fundamentally it's an old notion of the new world order. I mean, that conspiracy was even talked about by Carol Quigley in the, you know, in the 60s in his book, Tragedy and Hope. I mean, this is a Georgetown professor who wrote about the centralization of power, the desire for the Anglo-American empire, concentration of wealth and banking.
If you want a world government dictating to every country, you cannot have any superpowers with the financial and military might to say no to you. You can't. Because you're not a world government. So the idea has been to systematically destroy America financially and eventually militarily so that it can be absorbed into this world government structure.
The plan to create unified global government, currency, and legal structures is not a conspiracy theory. It is documented in British imperial conferences and American think tank papers throughout the 20th century. David Rockefeller, grandson of the richest man in the world at the turn of the 20th century and a chief benefactor of the Democratic Party, admitted, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it."
I had a friend, Nick Rockefeller, okay, who was one of the Rockefeller family. When I was running for governor in Nevada, he came to me, introduced himself to me through an attorney, and we became friends. We started talking about things. They would help me with this business investment or that business investment. And was I interested in joining the Council on Foreign Relations? You know, I would have to get a letter to join them, but was I interested in that? And, you know, just stuff, you know, leading you on. And I used to say to him that I never really did that because that wasn't where I was coming from. You know, as much as I like you, Nick, you know, your ways and my ways were on the opposite side of the fence. You know, it was just a lack of caring, you know, and that's just not who I was. It was just sort of like cold, you know, it was just like cold. I just said, what's the point of all this? You have all the money in the world you need. You have all the power you need. What's the point? You know, what's the end goal? And he said the end goal is to get everybody chipped, to control the whole society, to have the bankers, the elite people, you know, the bankers and some governor controlling the world.
The radio frequency identification chip, which is about the size of a grain of rice, allows users to open doors, swap contact details, and use the photocopier.
These things, it appears to me, began out of pure avarice, where bankers decided they had a very good deal. They could collect interest on money that they were creating out of nothing, and that gave them great influence and power over the kings and the princes of the world, who always were needing money to finance their wars and their pleasures. So it started off as a good con game, I think, but as it became with the passage of time and they could see where this was going, they were able to buy up governments. They could own governments because they could buy their kings and their queens, and later on they bought their elected representatives, like you buy hamburger in the grocery store. Just how much money does it take? Oh, $5 million for this guy? $9 million? Okay, do it. Get him on board. So they bought up governments, and suddenly then the game changed. It wasn't just how much money you could make and how big your yacht was going to be, but in terms of controlling all of mankind. And then generations passed, and new generations came in, and technology developed, and people came on the scene and were getting this idea about transhumanism, things that almost are beyond the pale of imagination. They want to change humanity. They don't like humans the way they are. Humans are too independent. They're too hard to control. You know, all this stuff costs money that they're doing. They have to brainwash us. They have to buy us off. They have to threaten us. They have to kill some of us. They have to scare us to death. It takes a lot of money. But they could just reprogram humankind into a new creature that you could just program in like you program your computer. So you will turn on at 7:15 in the morning and turn off at 11:30 at night, and you don't have to explain why. Just say, you will do it. That's what they want humans to do.
If that sounds far out, just consider that MKUltra involved government mind control programs that worked with private foundations, universities, hospitals, doctors, and scientists, some of whom, immediately after World War II, were already engaged in discussions on the interface between humans and the new computing machines. They called their study cybernetics, and some of them sought to reduce the human brain and nervous system to machine inputs and outputs, thus making the brain programmable.
This new core of knowledge replaced the classical understanding of the brain. It would now be treated as a biocomputer, to be scanned, screened, decoded, and reprogrammed.
And these people are convinced that scientists, by 2035, will be able to, for the first time, successfully transfer one's personality to an alternative carrier. In other words, to an avatar.
Really?
Are you surprised to see me, Joseph?
Can you prove you're self-aware?
That's a difficult question, Dr. Tiger. Can you can prove that you are.
Well, he certainly hasn't lost his sense of humor.
So the epoch of cybernetic immortality begins. The generation of our children is the last fully human generation of people, human beings, on the planet Earth. Their children are no longer going to be 100% human. They're going to be transhuman, post-human, augmented humans.
My first short film that I made was called Singularity, and it was exactly
that's right,
that question,
right.
Which is, you know, at the point that you lose that humanity, which is to say when you believe so completely in a scientific knowledge or computer-based knowledge as opposed to the faith, which makes us human, right? The ability to be flawed, to have faith in God, which is a transcendent, unknowable power, right? When that's taken out and our God becomes science, our God becomes the machine that dictates the rules and tells us we must behave this way and we must act according to these structures, then that's destroying that which is human, as we call human.
And what I saw in 2003 is that there was a mega conference in Hawaii, a meeting of all the top digerati, the technology people, the technocrati. And it was sponsored by, of course, the U.S. government, who was promoting the idea that in the coming decades, from 2003 forward, right into our present time, we are going to see a convergence of technologies, of our genetic technology, of our nanotechnology, our neuroscience, and our computer technology. They will all become one technology that converges in human skin. And when I first started on this path, I'm thinking, man, this is really pretty dark stuff. They're talking about imprisoning us in this new orange prison jumpsuit, this new layer of skin that's going to eliminate free will. Yeah, it'll give us super intelligence, superpowers, and all this kind of thing, but the idea of the individual will cease to exist because we're all going to be part of some AI super brain.
It's at the end, what the fourth industrial revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities.
Klaus Schwab is the founder of the World Economic Forum, where the super rich hobnob with politicians in Davos, Switzerland.
It is a family reunion for the people who, in my view, broke the modern world. It is a family reunion of the people who monopolized the future, who designed a world that would only work for them.
But he isn't the only oligarch interested in transhumanism. His friend Bill Gates has promoted genetic modification of crops and gene editing in humans. In the 1930s, that was considered eugenics, based on the belief that DNA determines everything from our looks to our intelligence. After the Nazis took that theory to an extreme, eugenics was rebranded as genetic engineering. It's worth noting that Gates's friend Epstein was also interested in genetic engineering, believing he could populate a super race with his sperm. No wonder Epstein sponsored MIT's Media Lab, born of the 1950s cybernetics studies. And what was cybernetics if not based in the desire to steer humans and their social systems using our biology?
So we've got to get people liking one another and working together. And what MindWar is suggesting is that a great deal of the factors which influence people to be this way are at the mechanical level, at the subconscious level, and can be controlled through technology, which is what the book is talking about. The danger of this, of course, is that these same technological controls could be used to control people in a negative way, to make them more antagonistic, which would lead you to an atmosphere something like Orwell's 1984.
Mind control research is not new. A scientific milestone in this area came in the 1960s when Dr. Jose Delgado demonstrated remote control over a charging bull. By connecting a radio antenna to electrodes inserted into the bull's brain, Delgado proved that the animal's aggressive impulses could be thwarted by electronically manipulating the bull's muscle reflexes.
Do you realize the fantastic possibilities if from the outside we could modify the inside? Could we give messages to the inside
But the beauty is that now we are not using electrodes.
In recent years, Delgado has shown that the behavior of monkeys can be altered using low-power pulsating magnetic fields. But in these experiments, there were no antenna implants.
Any function in the brain, emotions, intellect, personality, well, could be perhaps modified by this non-invasive technology.
As MKUltra experiments with drugs like LSD, electromagnetic radiation, and other technologies were able to demonstrate, to affect the body is to affect the mind. And just like with Plato's metaphor of the cave, mind control is the root of how elites rule a society. Bertrand Russell, the famed British philosopher and proponent of one world government, who wrote of a scientific dictatorship as early as the 1950s, foresaw a future where diet, injections, and injunctions will combine from a very early age to produce the sort of character and the sort of beliefs that the authorities consider desirable, and any serious criticism of the powers that be will become psychologically impossible. Even if all are miserable, all will believe themselves happy because the government will tell them that they are so. His friend Aldous Huxley echoed this vision.
If you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do, partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even. And so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
You know, when I do my hypnotic show in Las Vegas, Real Hypnosis Really Funny, I don't bring people on stage and immediately hypnotize them to sing like Madonna or strip like Chippendales dancers. It's a small process. So the first thing I've got to do is inspire them to get on stage. Come, enroll yourself. Get up on stage. There's going to be great benefits to it. You're going to feel like you slept for 10 hours. You're going to have more fun than anyone in the room. I get them on stage, and then I start getting small controls. Before I even start what they think is the hypnosis, stand up, trade places, move over here. You sit here. You stand behind these people. Because small commitments lead to large commitments. And when I can get somebody used to following little directives and then escalate them further and further and further, they don't realize till they're standing there singing like Madonna, you know, completely naked, how did they get here? Well, it all started when I said, sit down in that exact position.
And there is nothing more hypnotizing on a daily basis than the media we consume. Remember the prophet of the internet, Marshall McLuhan, and his paradoxical warning, the medium is the message.
Marshall McLuhan went to go speak with the Bilderbergs long time ago, and he discovered that when we shape our tools shape us. And that's a very key piece of information because of what's happening and how all these technology companies are ruling over us, not just financially, mentally, morally. They're dictating and being the moral police over us. Are you kidding me?
Get them off.
What would you tell us?
You're going out live.
We're in
trouble down here.
You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars.
First become aware of the kind of Illuminati influence and things like that. Like, what opens your eyes to that?
You know, just the whole idea of seeing how things are run. You know, if you really listen to the bobbleheads on TV today, especially the ones on the Alphabet Boys, the CNNs.
Exactly what people think.
And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
It's bad car salesmen.
Exactly. It's like, come on. The Native Americans said it, man. These cats speak with forked tongue. And you can see the lie written all over it. Even the whole idea in the political process, politics meaning the science of governing people. If you look at the whole vote, and I'm truly one of these kind of cats. I know and understand now that the Republicans and the Democrats, they're controlled by, you know, the same people.
Yeah. We've seen this since about 2012 at the Super Bowl halftime shows. It's an Illuminati ceremony. And so we have these award shows and the Super Bowl halftime shows using these ceremonies which propel and promote certain ideologies. And so it's a ritual to glorify this satanic doctrine. And so it's being used to subconsciously condition the viewers to love this kind of symbolism.
One of the things about, you know, if you go back to ancient ritual and ceremony, the concert is a tremendous amount of, you know, brings together a tremendous amount of energy, body of energy,
that is
potentially revolutionary. It's unfortunately been directed towards a lot of what you would call, like, idolatry, frankly, you know, the worship of the artist himself. You know, Jay-Z goes up there and people say, well, he's throwing up the rock or the pyramid sign, right? And essentially you're taking that mass of energy, that body of energy, and now directing it into something that's potentially unholy or that's not being used for something that is towards the social consciousness evolution.
Mm-hmm. We take these material things and acquisition of wealth and we put it as paramount. And as long as you get the money, everything is fine. No, that's not necessarily true. I mean, you know, we can kind of, the end justify the means? No, you're not pimping my children.
Well, when Kim Kardashian's out there being pimped by her parents and then she ends up marrying Kanye West and everyone's going, I love Kim Kardashian. Then that you're in a problem. I liked what Sinead O'Connor said to Miley Cyrus.
Oh, yes.
She pointed out, she basically said the satanic nature of the business. She said the music industry is using you and it's selling your sex to basically make profit from you and then it will discard you.
Exactly.
You know, and it's like, why are people offended by this? Why do people think that she's attacking Miley for it? It's nothing to do with Miley. She's telling you this is satanic. We are in a culture that uses people and we are okay with that idea. It's okay. Mm-hmm. We can use Professor Griff as long as he makes us money. As soon as he says something we don't like, we're going to discard him.
Yeah.
Everyone says, that's great. You made profit. That's amazing. You made money off him. What kind of morality are we teaching our kids?
Mm.
2 days after Prince announced that he would release his new album, Hit and Run, exclusively to Tidal, the singer revealed the reason he's sidestepping a record label and offering the LP directly through Jay-Z's streaming service. He also voiced his disapproval about how record labels turn artists into indentured servitude, since the artists have little control or insight over how labels take their music and profit off it online.
They've created a culture where people like Kesha, who now is seriously regretting signing contracts with Sony, crying in court because she's locked into a 6-year contract with Dr. Luke, who she accuses of sexual assault, might be fabrication to try to get out of her contract in order to try to persuade him to release her. But nonetheless,
it wouldn't be a stretch of the imagination to believe her manager was abusing her in some capacity.
It wouldn't be far-fetched to think that, and that kind of culture is almost the norm.
She's not backing down. Kaya Jones is standing behind her explosive claims involving one of music's most successful girl groups, the Pussycat Dolls, saying it was like being in a prostitution ring.
Some people are confused by it. You're clarifying that you weren't, you know, put in situations where you were being paid to have sex.
No, not paid to have sex, but if you're accepting an opportunity for sleeping with your boss or bosses or being propositioned that it'll go further if you do this, what's the difference between a job opportunity and cash? I don't really see a difference.
And this surprised me. I only found this out today. You're managed by the company you look after S Club 7 and used to look after the Spice Girls, Simon Fuller. Have they tried to mold you in any way, though, if people ask you to do things to change the way you look or speak or behave?
Yeah, one of them tried to mold me into a big triangle shape, and I went, no!
Nah, you know, I've got my own style.
We can take a look at Lady Gaga. So she has appeared to try to clean up her act, no more blood bathing and demonic imagery.
Do you record while the bus is moving, or does it have to come to a stop?
Yeah, well, sometimes they don't want to, and they're, you know, Gaga, we can't get, you know, the frequency is weird, and, you know, it's sounding a little bit strange, and I'm like, if you don't get this right now, I swear to Lucifer.
But she did, just a few years ago, do a music video and a song with R. Kelly, the infamous pervert. Just has all sorts of horrific allegations surrounding him regarding just despicable acts. He had been indicted, actually, on multiple child porn counts. Then those charges were thrown out due to supposed technicalities regarding the search warrant. So, you know, the audience could make up their mind about what he was or wasn't involved in. But Lady Gaga brought him back into the limelight
did a music video, which was directed by Terry Richardson, an infamous pervert that's hounded by allegations of, you know, sexual harasser. And so this guy produced this video where Lady Gaga slips into unconsciousness after being drugged and then is literally sexually assaulted by R. Kelly, and the dancers in the video, "Do What You Want."
Do What You Want sounds like a riff on "Do What Thou Wilt," the famous dictum of the secret society, the Hellfire Club, popularized in the 20th century by the self-proclaimed beast of the apocalypse, Aleister Crowley. Lodge brother to W.B. Yeats, ironically. Crowley had a huge influence on musicians in the 20th century, including the Beatles and Jimmy Page, who bought Crowley's mansion next to Loch Ness. Crowley's work inspired Anton LaVey to found the Church of Satan and its offshoot, the Temple of Set, as Michael Aquino assumed Crowley's mantle as the Beast, 666.
My question is, from a Setian point of view, if the idea of the ultimate goal being to realize one's own godhood, right, aren't you beyond good and evil at that point, or is there still a moral standard or code?
Well, the more that you become responsible for yourself, then the more you assert the responsibility to go beyond dictated conventions of good and evil.
We were in Dan Tanner's on that restaurant with all the pictures up. Danny was like, "You know, Satan is as powerful as God." And I was like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" He goes, "Why do you think there's so much anger in the world and killing and murder and Satan?" And he saw my reaction to it, and he kind of lightened up on it.
Ultimately, if I had to concress the ideology of Satanism down to one basic way of looking at the world, it's that I come first before everything else, and I don't care who else suffers as long as it's not affecting me. That's Satanism. So I espoused this ideology through writing and music, and eventually some of that work that I had done in music and in writing was recognized by the then high priest of the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey. He appointed me to the rank of priest within his organization, the Church of Satan. I began to become aware that these people were not just isolated groups of individuals that were working with hidden knowledge, which is what occultism is. It's knowledge that is not known by the general population about how the human mind works and how the laws of nature work. They were individuals that were working with this knowledge in a very, very tight-knit way, in a network, in a hierarchical system throughout the world, and they were comprised of an eclectic variety of people from every walk of life. You name the social institution, you name the part of our society, and there were Satanists involved in it at high levels and positions of power and influence. They were using this knowledge that they hold about how the mind works to manipulate people, and they were using the knowledge about the laws of nature to basically understand how whole dynamic societal forces work to bring people under their rulership. It wasn't people working separately just for their own personal benefit. It was a tight-knit unit of people throughout our entire society that was working very closely together in a networked, hierarchical, compartmentalized structure that was working toward a common goal. And that goal was to increase their own collective power, the collective power of this worldwide cult, you could call it, at the expense of everyone else's rights and freedoms to eventually create a worldwide dictatorship and worldwide slavery.
You have given us entree to the resources we need in our ongoing quest for multidimensional expansion. And in return, the per capita income of each of you here tonight has grown, and this year alone, by an average 39%.
Love one another, it has been said, is the supreme law. But what power made it so? Upon what rational authority does the gospel of love rest? Why should I not hate mine enemies and hunt them down like the most vicious of all beasts that they are? If I love them, does that not place me at their mercy? Is it natural for enemies to do good unto each other? And what is good? Can the torn and bloody victim love the blood-splashed jaws that rend him limb from limb? Are we not all predatory animals by instinct? If humans ceased wholly from preying upon each other, could they continue to exist?
All right, so here we are. There is 42 or now just about 41 and a half minutes left of the live broadcast. So if anybody is out there listening, call in 563-999-3698. And I am happy to chat and talk and go into overtime, but there's nobody in the chat, nobody in the queue. Don't know where everybody is today, but I'm just sitting here all by my lonesome and try to give it a few minutes here, but I haven't seen anybody connect and then drop or even check it out, so I don't know what's going on, guys. What is up today? Kind of quiet out there, internet radio land. And by the way, if you are trying to call in, if you have T-Mobile or Metro PCS, depending on the plan that you have, you might get a message saying that this number is not a part of your plan and will want to charge you 1 cent per minute. And if that is the case, that's what I get because I'm with T-Mobile. That's apparently on their end and not Blog Talk's end. But apparently I get that. And so when I call in using my cell phone, I have a Google Voice number I set up a long time ago. And that's my alternate number. And so it just uses my Google Voice internet phone number to make the call. But if you are trying to call in, you can go to the show's link. This episode link. And once you're there, you should see a direct connect button. So if you click on the direct connect button, it'll open up in your browser a little pop-up window with a dialer, and it'll automatically dial you in. It'll prompt you to put in your name, like your display name, so that you know, I know who you are. And you can use your browser to make the call instead. That's the workaround. That way it's free. And so you can use your, you know, phone's computer browser, usually Chrome or whatever it is that you're using, or if you're using a laptop or a computer, you can use your favorite browser, and you can do it that way, so that way you're not, you know, charged that 1 cent per minute. And I think, like, you know, from what I'm kind of gathering, like, there's been a lot of shows that have been getting less listeners. And I think that might be part of the reason why is people don't want to call in and be charged once per minute. But the hosts have the responsibility of letting people know that there is the direct connect option. Now, if the host only has the two-hour plan, then the direct connect option would not be available for guests to call in. But I am on the gold plan, which includes that. So that way, if you open up your browser and you go to my show's link, while the live broadcast is on, you should have the direct connect option. And you can just use it that way if you get that message. And again, this, so far as I know, this has only been happening with T-Mobile users and Metro PCS. But, you know, who knows? It could be starting to filter into other services for all I know. So that is a good option. And then so long as you're, you know, if you're using your computer, you should have a decent microphone. So if you have earbuds or headphones with a microphone or something, then that would work out pretty well to use that to call in and talk and stuff. And so, you know, I mean, there's 37 minutes left. And so if you want to call in, please do so. Otherwise, we could go on to part five, which is 30 minutes long. And like I said, I didn't really plan to play this many. I planned to play the first three to free up the second half of the show for people to call in and for us to have discussions. But if nobody's calling in, I don't want to sit here and talk to myself. We can talk about news. You know, but then again, there's also my Sunday show where I might have a guest, maybe, but I doubt it. I think probably next Sunday will probably be a good time to target because usually if I'm going to get a guest, if I don't confirm things up by Tuesday or latest to Wednesday, then it doesn't give me much of a chance to, like, you know, create the episode and include their information and post about it and promote it. I like to have adequate time to do that. And so I might be having a guest here probably in the next couple of weeks. And the guest is the founder of this new app called Votify Now. So you should check it out. It's a new app, Votify Now, VOTIFYNOW, okay? Votify Now, video demonstrating the election integrity tools. So this app is really kind of cool. I posted a YouTube video about it, and it is an election integrity tool where you can install the app and has multiple features that can help users of any party participate in voter integrity, learn more about candidates, school supervisor and city council meetings, elections, helps volunteers with canvassing, and more. Also, what it does is it's kind of like if it'll help report any issues that you might see, whether it be at, you know, ballot boxes or at the polls or whatever, if you are witnessing any kind of concerning behaviors or things involving the election, this app, you can notify the admins. So there's a, you know, group of admins that are usually like your county election officials, things like that, where you can report these issues. And then those issues also go out to other users as like a heads up. And so that can in turn prompt other users to go, hey, yeah, me over here, I'm seeing a similar thing. And they can report their issues. And so I think this is a really great tool. And so the founder of this new app might be a potential guest. And like I said, I just haven't firmed it up yet. I was hoping to for this Sunday, but perhaps next Sunday. So I'm going to have to reach out and see what's going on and see what works and hopefully get him booked to come on the show and talk about his app and all that. I think I love the idea. Part of using technology to do good, and I think this is a great thing. And that, and therefore, if you're seeing issues, if there's problems out there, it's not as easy to get buried if everybody's reporting it in an app, an independent third-party app, and that also includes your like precinct committee persons that can be admins of it. And you know, it's just a really kind of cool thing. Amber Richardson, former GOP candidate for Oregon governor here, is the one that turned me on to it and suggested I have him on the show. And so I might very well do that. But it's just a matter of timing. And so I still don't see anybody out there calling in. Nobody's on the switchboard. Nobody's on the chat. I've reached out to a couple people on Facebook, and no response there. So people are busy doing something. I don't know what. People are busy doing something. So I may as well go ahead and kick off part five, because why the heck not, right? Chapter five is called Blood Ritual, Best Kept Secret by Sean Stone. And, you know, they're really kind of getting into some of this stuff, aren't they? Really good information that's being presented. And so I may as well kick it off. I can barely squeeze it in because it is 30 minutes long. We've got 31 minutes left of the live broadcast. So now's your chance. If you want to talk, call in before the live broadcast ends here in about 31 and a half minutes, 563-999-3698, and then press number 1 to let me know you want to talk. And as long as you call in within the next 31 minutes, then once this clip is over, we can continue to talk and go into overtime and have some discussion. So here we go. I'm going to kick it off while I still can, while the live broadcast is here, since there's nobody on. I may as well crank this out, right? And then there's only part 6 that would be left after this. So here we go. 3, 2, 1, and launch.
In the 1970s, a long string of murders stunned New York City and the rest of the nation as time and time again couples out on dates were gunned down with seemingly no motive. The crime spree quickly gripped the nation's imagination when letters signed Son of Sam and a host of satanic references began to pop up at crime scenes and in reporters' mailboxes. After a year-long manhunt, police finally captured David Berkowitz, a socially withdrawn man in his 20s with satanic scrawlings all over his apartment, guns and ammunition in his car, and an enthusiastic confession to all the Son of Sam murders. But after some previous allegations and references, Berkowitz made shocking claims years later that he actually had only killed 3 of the victims, and that the others were slain by fellow members of, as he said, a satanic cult he was allegedly part of. The talk of a nationwide ring of satanic cults sounded like a far-fetched conspiracy theory back then, and it still does. But as it turns out, many of the NYPD detectives and prosecutors on the case had plenty of other doubts about Berkowitz being the only Son of Sam.
When Berkowitz was arrested in Yonkers in 1977, based on evidence that made him look more like a fall guy than the shooter who only matched one of the many eyewitness sketches from the half-dozen crime scenes, Berkowitz had left a note. This is a warning to all police agencies in the tri-state area. For your information, a satanic cult that has been established for some time has been instructed by the high command to begin to systematically kill and slaughter young girls or people of good health and clean blood. I, David Berkowitz, have been chosen since birth to be one of the executioners for the cult.
I know you don't like talking about the so-called Son of Sam letters, but I have one question. Would I be correct in saying that those letters were a group effort rather than the work of one individual?
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was a group thing. Again, part of the role, the goal, was to create an atmosphere of terror. You know, into Satanism, we felt that, you know, it was part of the thing, to create that atmosphere of a terror or fear or whatever.
When journalist Maury Terry got the NYPD to reopen the investigation into other shooters, 2 of the suspected cult members were actually sons of Sam Carr, Berkowitz's neighbor and owner of the dog that supposedly told Berkowitz to kill.
I want you to go out and kill.
Kill! Kill!
Berkowitz allegedly killed Sam Carr's dog. But in reality, many dead German shepherds had been found for years in neighboring Untermeyer Park, where the cult had been known to operate. Before the Sons of Sam could be questioned by police, they died. But it gets more bizarre when we learn Sam Carr operated a telephone answering service from his home, and one of his clients was the Clinic of Hudson River Counseling, an associate of Wainwright House, which itself was a hub for United Nations conferences as well as Lucis Trust meetings. The Lucis Trust had helped spawn the New Age as a publisher, formerly the Lucifer Publishing Company, before finding a home at the UN.
So they were concerned that you were basically reopening the investigation, although as I understand it, Yonkers has never officially closed the investigation into the actual Son of Sam killings.
No, they didn't. They absolutely did not, because they knew there was much more to it. Because remember, I had the person that took me there long before Berkowitz was ever there, because he only got out of military, I believe, in 74. By this time, we had developed a whole underground of information. And like I said, there were a number of investigations, very high level, and every one of them was shut down. But they all touched on this. Because you got to remember, in those days, New York City, especially Times Square and that, was a free-for-all. There were hundreds of kids there with no homes. Nobody knew who they belonged to, so it was a perfect feeding ground, you know?
Now, you said that you were basically were told this was an issue of national security and it was shut down at a higher level. Why would it be classed as an issue of national security? Who was looking to protect this type of satanic activity?
Ben Rose was a pharmacist, but what I said is that when I was given the term in the street, he was known as Dr. Rockefeller, and he was supplying little boys and girls to the United Nations and that group of people. How are they going to respond to the fact that they were using kids to compromise people? You know, in the intelligence world, when you compromise somebody, you can get him to cooperate any way you want. And what we called it was human intelligence and human compromise. And this was my specialty. And we found out how big this was when I started my investigations.
But to get back to the issue of the Son of Sam shootings and that particular issue, why do you think that this cult expressed itself in a reign of terror for a year, basically, with these random shootings?
That is something I never quite found out or learned about, although it had to do with some type of ritualistic, how would you call, basis or background to it, where they were satisfying some ritualistic goal. That's the only thing that I could ever figure out.
In New York City during the Son of Sam situation, for instance, some of the people who were involved in that cult, who were involved with Berkowitz and some of the friends of Berkowitz, were people who were very wealthy. Now, these were wealthy, in some cases, real estate tycoons, and in one case, a very famous fashion designer was very much involved as well. And these were people who had money, they had influence over a lot of people, they had influence in media, they had influence in finance, and they were very deeply involved in the cult practice. And these were not fools, these were not, you know, empty-headed people. These were people who were living, you know, for the dollar every single day. You know, they were earning money, they were buying and selling, they were hard-hearted, pragmatic people who simultaneously were involved in the serious study of occultism.
When you really start to explore the occult, if you approach it with logic, like a Rorschach test, it can appear a blurry mess. But if you can trust your intuition, you may begin to see synchronicities and patterns that are startling, often with connections to your own life. In the Son of Sam case, I was surprised to find that Entermeyer Park, the location of satanic rituals next to Berkowitz's apartment, was originally part of an estate called Greystone.
So that is Medusa in the center.
My first film was Greystone Park, named after the abandoned mental hospital where we ventured at night and found indications of satanic gatherings to call upon supernatural forces. The Masonic historian Manly P. Hall explains, black magic often involves conjuration and contract with spirits.
I have met people who claimed to be Satanists, who claimed to be involved with black magic, who claimed that they not only knew a lot about it, but as I said, I've certainly never been involved, and I warn all of you, never, never, never. You will not only lose your mind, you lose your soul.
What we call lesser black magic would consist of operations within the objective universe using little known or little understood laws to influence events and behavior and perceptions. And what we call greater black magic is probably more what you're thinking of in terms of ritual or ceremonial magic, which has to do with looking into yourself to explore and refine your own concept of yourself and your soul.
You can see that the earth magic, the shamanism of the Native American Indians, especially the Hopi, they are interacting with, say, for example, the forces of the atmosphere, rain dances, sun dances, this type of thing. They are using magic, and they are using it in harmony with the seasons, and they are using it primarily to contact the spirits of their elders for guidance on general tribal life. Now, if you can imagine this pendulum swinging away from earth magic and the Native American shamanism, the opposite is Satanism. You can see two main phenomena
you can see blood ritual. This is a very, very important thing for them. And yes, it's been going on since before recorded history. But alongside that blood ritual, we can see blackmail as, if you like, a way of connecting reins to each and every one of the members in that coven. They witness and take part in a blood ritual to enter that coven.
Have you heard Ronald Bernard's testimony?
Yes, I was with him in London when we had these hearings.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so you...
Yeah, this is the way they do it. I know it because they tried it with me too.
Ik kwam dus ook in die kringen. Alleen ik lachte erom, want het waren voor mij gewoon klanten. He, dus ik kwam in wat ze noemden Satanskerken.
Ik wou zeggen, we hebben het nu over het satanisme.
Ja.
Okay.
Ik kwam dus in Satanskerken, maar ik kwam zeg maar op route even langs, even buurten. En daar was dan op dat moment een heilige mis, hun heilige soorten mis. En dat was met blote vrouwen en wat drank en dit en dat. En ik vond het alleen maar leuk. Maar er kwam een moment, toen werd ik dus uitgenodigd, daarom vertel ik dit ook, om mee te gaan doen aan offers in het buitenland. Dat was het breekpunt. Kinderen.
Okay. Dat werd je gevraagd.
Ja, ik kon het niet.
The origin of Satanism, Luciferianism, whatever label you want to put on, is the harnessing and exploiting of vital essence of children for the purposes of gaining power or life extension. Or a lot of people, when we looked into the research and saw all the files of the survivors, they didn't start off that way. They were blackmailed into it and forced into it.
It appears though she never existed.
And when I found out, and both of us knew how that blackmail was done, a lot of these people were reluctant. But if they're not participating in it specifically, they're made to look at it. Just looking at it is a form of abuse, and it's done to desensitize the self.
Not with these swain, which hither ye have brought from regions where I reign. Ye fools and priests, I spit upon your fire.
We're in Monterio, California, investigating the Bohemian Club. It's one of the most exclusive and secretive societies in the world. Every summer, the club holds a retreat at a place called The Grove. And many of the club are some of the richest and most powerful members of our country. We're talking about presidents, cabinet members, CEOs, generals, even Hollywood celebrities. The club has a strict policy of never revealing what goes on behind the gates of The Grove. There are a variety of stories about what happens at the meetings, including decisions about, if you want to believe this, who even gets to run for president.
Well, I snuck into Bohemian Grove 16 years ago, back in 2000, and there had been probably more than 15 different journalists from People Magazine, CBS Television, Time Magazine, you name it, who had snuck in but been caught inside. And most of it's a bunch of, old Republicans with, their gay prostitutes having orgies. There's not a bunch of satanic stuff going on most of the time.
It's a playground for the powerful. It's a place where wealthy men from all of the United States gather for 2 weeks to relive summer camp with this ceremony called the Cremation of Care that begins the two-week encampment where the body of dull care symbolizing woes and concerns is burned on an altar front of a big owl statue. When that ceremony ends, they all start to cheer and yell and hand each other a beer.
And so they're there just kind of having this bohemian revelry in the woods, in the Hall of the Mountain King, as they call it, because they actually play that theme in the background, but fusing Babylonian and Egyptian and Aztec and Druid rituals together to basically have the goddess who they're worshiping pass over them and put judgment on the simulated human sacrifice that they're about to kill for the crimes they've committed. So it's a ripoff kind of the Israelites or other cultures where they would kill a ram, or in the case of, folks like the founder of the three major religions, Abraham, where he was told, kill your son, but then the angel stayed his hand. Mm-hmm. And it's clearly a serious magic ritual. The men in attendance took it very, very serious.
Bohemians and priests, the desperate call of heavy hearts is answered. By the power of your fellowship, dull care is slain.
The owls are not what they seem.
Why did you bring this to me?
I was raised in Belgium and sold into a murderous pedophile network right around my 6th birthday. I was used in this network for 5.5 years. Adult men that were part of this exclusive club were there for various reasons, but there was a lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs, and the children were the commodity, the highest, the most valued commodity, and were used for sex mostly. But there were a number of aristocrats that were part of this club who also liked killing children. And then my time had come. At the age of 11, I was about to be killed. I was tortured because someone who had protected me for a while and then abused me really badly was done with me. I was strapped to a butcher's block. That was black from the blood of all the children that had come before me. I was there for a few hours. My body is full of scars, and every scar reminds me of the moment. I thought that I was going to be killed like all the children that weren't loved enough to live. And I was going to be forgotten as well. And I wasn't ready to die. Someone from inside that network loved me enough to rescue me.
The prime suspect in a case of child sexual abuse and murder that's horrified Belgium. Prosecutors say that Marc Dutroux has now confessed to leaving two young girls to starve to death and to kidnapping two others. His wife, who like her husband has been jailed before for pedophilia, is also being questioned. The hope in Brussels is that the authorities have finally cracked a major pedophile ring.
Oh, there were hundreds of people calling that they had been, that's where it started, that they had been in the most horrific networks as children, and they recognized some of these handlers being involved in the Dutroux case. And then strange things happen. Where you see that, and I'm talking about 25 years ago already, you see, where you see things happening that are not possible.
In all, 20 people connected with the case have died in suspicious circumstances. Also not appearing is Regina Louf, whose police interviews in 1996 appear to support the existence of a paedophile ring involving rich clients and run by Michel Nihoul. But the police investigation into Regina's claims was halted in 1997.
We still ask ourselves the same question, why? We were just doing our work, we were objective. Why the hell did they stop us?
The Dutroux-Nihoul case proved to be a sordid affair for Belgium, as only Marc Dutroux was ultimately convicted of the abduction, rape, and murder of half a dozen young girls. But it was clear that he was part of something much bigger. Judge Jean-Marc Conero, who helped rescue two of the victims, was dismissed from the case, leading to a demonstration by hundreds of thousands. He later testified that the police had known much more about Dutroux, Michel Nihoul, and the network they serviced. The file talks of seizure of children, foreign trafficking, and perhaps even of cells, if I remember well. The sum of 150,000 francs was mentioned as the price for girls. I was struck by the richness of these documents.
In terms of the Belgium network, then, how high up did that go? Did that go to the top of royalty and politics?
Yes. Those were the people. The very top of the whole society. Those were the people who were involved. And it was a system that those who wanted to get involved, who wanted to climb that social ladder, were being indoctrinated through pedophilia. So someone who would have a conscience would be out right in the beginning, because it's gradual. The indoctrination is gradual.
It's amazing how obvious. I mean, it's like the satanic nature of a lot of our foreign policy, right? The warmongering of many years. I remember Madeleine Albright was asked.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
It's crazy, but look at Stalin. What did Stalin say? One death is a drama. Millions of deaths are statistics.
Are our world leaders psychopaths?
Many are. The main thing with psychopaths and also borderline, people who suffer from borderline personality disorder, is control. They want control.
When Eyes Wide Shut came out and they were all wearing the masks in the ceremony, that's to create disassociation. That's what it's designed for, some conditioning. The plan was to create a psycho-civilized society, done now through the big pharma, to create a society of people that is angry, resentful, vindictive, has to have power over others, has no sense of community, is self-destructive.
In my mother's case, she had been exposed to enough of a high-level aspect of things to have compartmentalized memory. When a person has compartmentalized memory, they have no continuity of thought. They have no awareness of what just happened. They therefore have no concept of time. They don't have an ability to be in control of their own mind and life. And in my mother's case, it was exactly that way. In my case, it was a little more extreme, where my daughter Kelly was concerned. I couldn't protect her at all because I couldn't even protect myself from mind control. With no continuity of thought, there's no ability to stand up for anything that you believe in. And ultimately, that's what mind control of a whole nation does too, is it starts eroding the ability to take a stand, to stand for the moral aspect of society.
Well, mind control was the stuff Mengele and the Nazis were doing. What Aquino specifically did was, you know, called mind construction. It's probably easier to give as an example. One that I give is, you know, with this pandemic, you know, they'll say, you know, if you want to be a good citizen, if you're globally minded, you'll wear a mask, because you care about your elderly neighbors, you care about the safety of the people around you.
I wear a mask to ensure the safety of the people around me.
I wear a mask for you.
Well, so, you know, your will may be, I don't want to wear a mask. I'm not going to wear a mask.
A bloody fight erupts after a woman in Manhattan Beach throws coffee at a man not wearing a mask.
On a Southwest Airlines flight, and according to witnesses, centered around passengers who were not wearing masks over their nose.
But now what they've done is they've appealed to your ethical and your moral constructs. And so you think, if I don't wear a mask, then I'm not being a good person. And it displays that I don't care about my neighbors. I don't care about their life or their death. So, you know, what is your will going to do? You want to be a good person. You want others to know that you care about them, that you care about life and death. So you're going to wear a mask.
The rule is very simple.
get vaccinated or wear a mask until you do.
Here you go. Continue to wear a mask.
Huh. Good luck, guys. Keep the breeze.
I think there's just like a COVID fatigue. So like whenever a new story comes up, they're going to latch onto it. They've already announced in her office that once the public will be open to it, we're going to start focusing mainly on climate climate, like global warming, and like that's going to be our next, like, I don't know, like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's going to be our focus. Our focus was to get Trump out of office, right? Without saying it, that's what it was, right? So our next thing is going to be for climate change awareness.
The thing for me is just like a lot of like fear, like climate.
Yeah, fear sells.
One control mechanism is through manipulation. So although they can't say you have to do this, they can feed into our systems fear and subconscious, you know, programming and these kind of things, so that we only have one choice in front of us, and it's feed into the matrix, it's feed into the system, it's be in fear all the time, which feeds into their paradigm. We've allowed this to happen because we didn't know that there was another reality we could experience.
There are some who say that evil doesn't exist, or it cannot be explained. It's a mental defect, or it's cultural. But if we study the history of occultism and why it continues to fascinate, we cannot discount possession, black magic, and satanic beliefs to explain certain things.
Are there cases in which a possession is not obvious?
I would
imagine there are many where the spirit has simply won and is in firm control. I would think that the people who come to you are those who are sort of in the middle of a giant battle.
That's right. When you find some, you know, the typical things of somebody throwing themselves on the ground or cursing and spitting and protesting and
defecating,
yes, urinating and all sorts of protest. What they're doing is protesting, saying, help me.
Yes.
Help me. The perfectly possessed, we call them the perfectly possessed, are those that are completely at peace. And I've known several of the perfectly possessed, and I avoid them like the pest.
But it is going to bother you because you're human, and I was human. I am human still.
When my father would manifest his devil spirit, and usually when he wanted to kill someone or perform some other satanic ritual, they let the entity take over their bodies. So the vibe coming off of them totally changes to an archon. Totally, and it's child-killing, pedophile, mass murderer, total evil. It is so evil, so vicious, that it's jaw-dropping. And my father's eyes would flash black, solid black, when he would switch to the archonic energy.
All demons are essentially elemental entities that feed off human suffering, human failure, human foible. We are a food source. We're a cattle to them. They need us to exist. For that reason, all demons that we acknowledge within the occult inventory of diabology are entities that would never dream of exterminating humanity. They need humanity to thrive in order to feed off its corruption and those elements of humanity which fail.
Can't be! No!
Look at his hands.
His feet! Oh, God!
God is dead! Satan lives! The year is won!
We came across the book, The Franklin Cover, by John DeCamp. And it was this horrific affidavit by Paul Bonacci about how he was in Bohemian Grove, or a Bohemian Grove type place, and they made a snuff movie of him and another small boy, and this guy came in and raped both of them, and then shot the head off this little boy.
Wasn't the allegation that Hunter S. Thompson was involved in filming that snuff film?
That's what was really strange. It said the filmmaker was H.S. Thompson, according to Paul Bonacci.
I like to kill.
And when you say kill, you're talking about what, neighbors? What?
We don't want to talk about shooting people, do we?
No, but you're teasing when you say you like to kill, right?
Yeah.
So it begins to make you wonder that he made a statement one time. He said, the best way I could cover corruption is to dive into it. And he said, I wouldn't recommend this, but drugs and alcohol helped me. I just started seeing clips of the movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas when he was, some guy told him to take this stuff. It's called adrenochrome.
What is this shit?
That stuff makes pure mescaline seem like ginger beer, man. Adrenochrome.
Adrenochrome?
The adrenochrome connection certainly would indicate that he was on to something, right? The fact that someone gave him adrenochrome, and then he talks about shape-shifting. He sees, like, reptilian creatures, right? He sees that some humans are not humans, and they look like reptiles.
I was right in the middle of a fucking reptile zoo. Somebody was giving booze to these goddamn things. It won't be long now before they tear us to shreds.
All right, so that was the conclusion of part five, and the live broadcast, well, only 5 seconds left. Nobody's called in, nobody's on the chat. I am just sitting here all by my lonesome. But the show recording is still happening, so if by any chance you listen to the recording, I'm going to go ahead and just play part six. It's 26 minutes long, I may as well. Instead of having part six next week, when it's just the one part, I'm sure I can come up with something, you know, different for next week. But so if you are listening to the recording of this, I'm going to go ahead and play part six and wrap up this whole documentary on Best Kept Secret by Sean Stone, which, again, I encourage you to go ahead and listen to or go and watch the videos on BitChute or anywhere else that you find the whole documentary, The Best Kept Secret by Sean Stone. And I'm going to go ahead and do part six. And see, part six, 26 minutes long. And so here we go.
This is W9GFO here. Come back.
There are people who claim that these creatures are gods. There are people, sir, who claim that these creatures are experimenting on us. That is a lot of rubbish. These creatures are harvesting us. These creatures are not aliens, Mr. Ike. These creatures are sexually compatible with our women. And what does that tell you? It tells you that they came from here. They are part of us. And this makes them all the more dangerous. They know us very, very, very well. They know the great weaknesses of our minds, just as they know the great strengths of our minds. They operate in what I call the gray area of human existence, that side of our lives which we don't want to acknowledge the existence of. They create, African tradition says that the Chitauri, where they engaged God himself in a terrible war and God defeated them, the real God, Nkulunkulu, the creator. God defeated them and he closed their mouths so that they are unable to talk or to eat food anymore. But we are told, friend, that the Chitawuli fatten on the energy that we human beings give them.
Now some of you are thinking, oh no, we're going off the deep end here with David Icke and the reptilians.
America, take a good look at your beloved candidates. They're nothing but hideous space reptiles.
Never mind that the devil is depicted as a serpent in the Bible, and many ancient cultures speak of dragons and lizard people. In fact, one of the most intriguing traditions to look at is that of the so-called Gnostics, who believed in the Christ while deriving much of their lineage from the Magi of ancient Persia.
The reason we're here, Sean, is to learn and grow in consciousness. Now, there's the All-Father, according to the Gnostics, and I call that the zero-point energy field consciousness that is love. And then the template of where we're at, this holodeck we're in, this virtual consensus reality, it is the Divine Mother who made this reality so she could make the Anthropos, which is the human being, which can be a go-between between the Godhead and three-dimensional reality. Now, very tough thing to do. I'm sure when my parents told me that this is the fifth or sixth world age that the Anthropos, the human race, has gone through, it's probably true. We build ourselves up and then we destroy ourselves. They claim that the Demiurge did that, the Chief Archon.
Yaldabaoth is a strange name you only find in the Gnostic writings. They also call him Samael or Sakras, fool, blind one. The base, extraterrestrial base of the Archons is Saturn. And you think of it as a radio station. So they broadcast from Saturn. Now, the Yaldabaoth is sort of like the main broadcaster. It's the center of the Archonic hive mind. They do have a mind, but it's more like an insect mind. They're like insect cyborgs. The Gnostics warned us that about their powers, and one of their powers is called Hal, which literally means virtual reality or simulation. So they can project themselves into the human psyche and appear as if they are here in our environment by using Hal. In fact, the people who have had these close encounters and the abduction experiences, which are actually described in the Gnostic text, it's as if you had put the headset around them. The ancient seers were specific in describing the Archons in their exobiological or extraterrestrial form. And they said that there were two types. They said there's one described by the bizarre trope, which you only find in the Gnostic writings, of the aborted fetus. So it looks like it has a big head, bug eyes, spindly limbs, and there you have the portrait of the gray aliens. Additionally, they said there was another type, which was a Dracon, which translates as reptilian.
I have static memories of being in the presence of reptilians, kind of like snapshots. And my parents, one time when I was about 4 or 5, were bemoaning, Sean, that they could not shapeshift into a full reptilian. And what they said was, we do not have enough of the corruption in us.
Shapeshifting may sound crazy, but it has been part of myths throughout the world. Just think of the Greek gods who took human form. Alexander the Great's mother claimed it was the spirit of Zeus that conceived her world-conquering son. European troubadours sang of pregnancies from shape-shifting dragons. The Chinese believed the dragon to have been involved in the creation of humans, and their generations of emperors were dragons incarnate. Modern society can scoff and call that unscientific, but we have only now come to learn that scientifically we do not see the majority of reality.
What you see is an illusion. It's an approximation. You are actually a wave coexisting with other parallel waves, each wave vibrating at a slightly different frequency. And some of these waves can go in different directions, leaving you in the room. On average, however, on average, what you see is what you get. So objective reality of Newton is an illusion. It's an approximation to the quantum reality.
The body is a holographic projection of an energetic information field. The energetic information field on one level is what we call the auric field. It's an electromagnetic field. And it can be photographed and it can be technologically measured. Now, these parasitical entities are operating at that electromagnetic and beyond to the deeper realms of waveform. That's the level they're operating at. So what they're doing is not possessing the body or the brain. They are, in frequency terms, making a frequency electromagnetic connection with the auric field. And through that, they are feeding off that energy. They feed off low vibrational emotional energy. And thus, the more that society can be structured to create maximum fear, maximum anxiety, frustration, anger, depression, the more we, at the electromagnetic level, drop into the frequency range that is represented by those emotional states, i.e. the frequency ranges that these entities operate at. Thus, there can be a frequency connection, and there can be not only a parasiting, a vampiring of our energy field as their food source, which is what the ancients talked about, but also it can come the other way in terms of dictating our sense of reality while we think we're thinking, feeling something that is of our own generation. Actually, it's coming from another force.
What the hell are you?
We are Venom. On second thought, please.
Did you or Bowert ever come across this blood drinking stuff? Because before, you know, I had heard the reptilians fed on blood, you know, and I always suspected there was a vampiric or demonic component to a lot of the ritual. But then obviously when people come out with adrenochrome in the recent years and then they say this is all like, oh, this is, you know, some Q fantasy, I just was curious what, in terms of the research that you guys did pre-2010.
He mentioned it to me when he got into it a little bit with me. He was very careful about what he said. He was very slow to deliver his findings, but he was saying that there were, the blood harnesses sexuality. All the sexuality is about moving information from point A to point B in terms of propagation of species. Blood rituals, which he, when he brought that up to me, was about the exploitation of that energy.
There were a lot of things that I witnessed that, you know, were like secrets that you wish you didn't have to hold on to. People would be wearing black robes with hoods, you know, so you couldn't see their faces. And they'd be walking in a line, chanting the usual things that satanic cults do, like drink blood. They do that.
The mainstream media would have you believe critical thinkers are a danger to the rest of the population. Free thinkers are now reduced to labels: alt-right extremist, conspiracy theorist, anti-vaxxer, climate change denier, Q cultist, who resort to the old blood libel, the power elite are eating babies, like the vampire myths that are common to cultures around the world. The black magician Aleister Crowley wrote, "It was a theory of the ancient magicians that any living being is a storehouse of energy, varying in quantity according to the size and health of the animal. At the death of the animal, this energy is liberated suddenly." Interesting that now we are told Silicon Valley is investing in science that seeks rejuvenation for the elderly in the blood of the young, as though Bluebeard and Elizabeth Bathory were onto something. And now, rappers who claim children as their main audience are turning into devils and selling blood in their shoes.
The company confirmed to NBC News yesterday that there is a drop of blood in the soul, apparently.
I don't know if you've had anyone come out saying specifically that they've seen this kind of engagement, you know, from ritualistic perspective of actual drinking or eating, you know, eating cannibalism.
Many, many.
Yes.
And the youngest victims I heard, I have this on tape, were three-year-old twins who told me that they were there and high-ranking people. And they had to help killing a baby. And then the blood was collected into special bottles. And they had to drink them. They were twins near to Paris. And it was nobility because they told the mother where it was. She couldn't believe it.
What it's all about is that the blood and the menstrual blood contain something that is important for the propagation of this race that is controlling things on this planet. They need the blood because they are, in fact, not human. They take human shape. They are reptilians, and they need the blood. The blood helps them maintain their reptilian shape, and it helps them maintain their sanity, and it helps them to live in this world because they are not from this world.
The blood rituals that they have, so reptilians don't need human blood to survive. But the reason why they drink this blood is to reverse aging. Yep. And the second reason why they drink blood is to actually, it makes so much sense, is to gain access to our powers and abilities. We have tons of extrasensory abilities, but also DNA capabilities that we've never actually expressed.
The blood is what gives us authority, dominion, and so it's about that dominion. When they drink that blood, wherever that person has walked, wherever they've been, they believe it gives them access to that land and that dominion that that individual had. Everything on Earth resonates a frequency, a resonance, has a harmonic song. Okay, so these spiritual gates operate at that frequency of thanksgiving. The enemy cannot be thankful to open the gates. The true thankfulness is gone because they've all been cast out of heaven. They've been cast from the presence of God. So what's the closest thing that they can get to that same frequency that will open those spiritual gates? And that's delight or ecstasy. So how do the spiritual gates operate? And this is important to that question. Scripture tells us that, you know, we enter the gates with thanksgiving in our heart. You know, really what they're doing with the pedophilia, it's not about necessarily lust or, you know, a sick desire to harm children. Like, it's about that sex magic. And to appease Satan, to appease the demons, to reach those higher levels in that system, you have to be good at sex magic. And unfortunately, the only way they can get that is, you know, they have to involve children.
My father, I can remember him raping me, and it was almost like the energy of my heart, of my life, was being drawn through him to the etheric entity inside him. The suffering and dissatisfaction of the human soul is what feeds the archonic devil spirits.
And you describe some of them as psychopaths in business suits.
Dinosaurs in business suits, I think.
The dinosaurs in business suits, yeah. Is that because they had common characteristics or that made you classify them like that? Or was there a variety of preferences and abuse scales that they registered on?
The dinosaur is a reference to the brain, the reptilian brain.
The reptilian brain stem consciousness is just about money, greed. It's comfort, profit, and greed. And when consciousness is locked in there, all we can focus on is the four F's. Feeding, fighting, fearing, dare I say, fucking. It's about consciousness. Everyone is stuck in reptilian brainstem until they've initiated and opened up to frontal lobe neocortex and done the work to alchemize the soul and eventually the spirit back into matter.
It's said that Hollywood movies are rooted in sex and violence, which most stimulate the reptilian part of our brain. It could be epitomized in sadomasochistic sexuality, featuring a need for control and inflicting pain, which we have referenced throughout this story. Angelina Jolie was alluding to it in a leaked video from early in her career that even referenced the possibility for blackmail and sacrifice that we see within these elite networks.
Like I was filming that everybody cares, like everybody's all different types of visuals, but there is that thing where like a lot of people are just and they think it's super, and I have to like explain to people how, like, where it's more like you're tied down because you need to like be able to like have somebody hold you down and keep you still, or like you fight something down and be able to heal once you're beaten like for something. It's surprising to be able to like hear such like just sexuality or just, but it's so weird when you just I had like the most amazing compromising pictures of people. My snake, I had it back.
Do you believe in the Illuminati?
Absolutely.
Is it from research or from like any personal experience?
No, I like it says I know that they exist. Back in, you know, when I was around 20 years old, I was introduced to a lot of people being kind of the rage out in New York City, and I had met some people that introduced me as being part of an organization which had to have been the Illuminati. But it was on Staten Island. It was a big mansion. They had guards walking on the walls. It was all lit up, and you know, and I went in there, and he, you know, was this art dealer guy, and he was not what he, you know, what he was. And they were very interested in my skills and my talents, if I would get involved with some of their projects and stuff like that. And they, you know, I just, my gut feeling was, this is not the place I want to be, and these are not the people I want to be involved in.
It was very dark, negative energy.
Yeah, I don't want to call it a sex parlor, but that's kind of how it felt. You know, it felt like, you know, red candles in there. They had their altar in the middle down there. I mean, and these are big people with big money at the time.
I think Kubrick pointed it out in the film Eyes Wide Shut very accurately.
Yeah.
What is the need for the sexual nature of the magic? You know, why the sexuality behind it?
Well, I think it's just common sense. I think the common sense is that it's one of the strongest human needs. It's a human drive, and it's a number of things. It's procreation makes it one of the strongest drive versus just as much as eating or needing water or breathing. It's more or less a great recruiting tool for them because it's like, here, you can indulge in this. And it's a great way to then convert people over to your thinking. You socialize, you have, and it's also like you got to keep our secret.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a bonding there also. So I think it's a big recruitment system.
When you've got a vehicle like our body that's capable of manufacturing very precious secretions, enlightenment secretions, that's effectively a battery, you can harvest energy from it. This could be like a plantation planet where they're harvesting something from our bodies. Numerous traditions speak of that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be a motivation for an extraterrestrial race to come here. But I'm also a specialist in the Tibetan rainbow body or great perfection tradition that tells of these benevolent beings, the bodhisattvas, who came to Earth in order to raise our awareness about our ability to transform our body into a next level of vibration they call the rainbow body, which enables access to stargates, wormholes that connect us up to as many as 13 star systems, which the Tibetans say were sort of a colony, if you will, in this federation, to use a Star Trek term, of star systems that are all interlinked. So there's different ways we can twist this diamond, and you're going to get the reflection based on the way you look through the diamond.
We are multidimensional beings, right? We have light bodies that we can't see maybe to the naked eye, but many, many traditions have talked about this and working on activating it, right? Our kundalini energy, our chakra system. This seems to be very much what the archons are feeding upon, right? In terms of their agenda is very much to feed upon it, to try to manipulate it. And then our job is to essentially activate and come into our fuller lighted potential.
Well, there are two great deterrents to the archons. first place, Kundalini is a zapper for the Archons. And unfortunately, needless to say, due to certain nefarious and degenerative influences, very few people in our time have that privilege. If you have a strong, good, sane, balanced sexuality, you already have tremendous resistance to the Archons. The other factor of resistance is, of course, in your mind, because they're a mind parasite.
Now, what's really weird is when every avatar, from Krishna to Buddha to Jesus Christ, every single one of them said, go within and bring what is within out. Bring your inner consciousness. Break the shell of your programming in this world. I mean, break the spell of go along to get along. Break the spell of ignorance.
They think they're gods. They have conditioned us to think we're not, but we are. And part of the awakening process is to realize that we're part of the Godhead. To be in the Godhead means you have to understand that you're the ultimate creator, you're eternal, and everything in your universe you put there.
When you open your heart, when you're in a state of love, when you're in a state of compassion, when you're in a state of integrity, your vibrational state rises to the frequency level that is represented by that state, and never the twain shall meet. You become unpossessable because you're not in the frequency range that they can access. It's like being on two different television stations or radio stations.
They couldn't make me evil because that's not my energy. My innate energy is love, and they can't change that. That's the spirit they can't touch. That's what they're so scared of. That's why they want to control the mind so that they inhibit our expression of it. They know that the strength of the human spirit is our saving grace.
For too long, our fear is how the shadows have ruled us. Because fear shuts down the mind, the heart, the spirit. The time has come for us to take our power back from the beast. For as Creator Mukwa said, that beast lives even within us. But when we face it, we shine our light on it. And in the light, we awaken to a new day.
Imagine a world where hugs are greetings, where words are honored because we are genuinely happy to share this world with each other. Imagine a world where contracts are expansions and agreements are oral because goods are transacted between friends until all share in the wealth. Imagine a world where you're not seen as a commodity because millions won't follow soulless posers, ignoring the cues of social engineers, for we are all creators. Imagine a world where people do what's right by trusting their intuition, no matter what their leaders and laws tell them to. Imagine a world where the sickness in our souls is treated as carefully as a doctor working in the ER, knowing that healing only happens inside. Imagine a world where feelings are valued enough to be expressed instead of scoffed at, because in the eyes of the young is the heart of the mature. Imagine a world where imagination is honored and society looks at its own shadows rather than projecting them out onto others. We'd all be set free. Imagine if we stopped trying to force the world the way we want it to be and started to love our life just the way it is. Imagine if every child were told that they are enough. Instead of competing for more, we'd make room for everyone.
Okie dokie, everybody, that wraps it up. If you're listening to this recording, I'm going to wrap up the show. Make sure to tune in to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann show, the regular normal show on Sunday night, 6 to 9 p.m. Pacific time, 9 to midnight Eastern time. And hopefully everybody out there is doing okay. And again, if you want to go back and watch these videos, I encourage you to do so. look up Sean Stone. Sean Stone, S-E-A-N, Stone, Best Kept Secret. And we played all six parts of it. And I encourage you to watch the videos as well. So tune in on Sunday night. I hope you have a great rest of your week, everybody. God bless. And I think the overall message of this series is make sure to feel love for others, connection with others, stand in the frequency of love and not the frequency of fear, and we'll make ourselves a better and better world. So with that said, again, have a great week. Have a great night. Goodbye.